serving as one of the technical moderators for today's live broadcast. In a few moments, we'll actually kick off the technical portion of today's session. But before we do that, I want to walk through a few technical reminders for the webinar so everybody understands how things will run. Hopefully you're joining us for today's Military Munitions Support Services webinar. This is the first webinar in their fiscal year 15 series where we'll be looking at munitions constituents. Dwayne will take a bit more time to explain the series and our topic today, and let me talk a little bit about the webinar and how we'll be running things today. You should have, when you registered for today's broadcast, received an email which has a complete set of instructions on how to join us for the live session. That email will ultimately point you to something known as the seminar homepage. On that homepage, you can read more about the broadcast. You'll find links to the previously hosted M2S2 webinars. There's also, if you scroll further down on the page, an agenda for today's broadcast. You'll find contact information and bios for our broadcasters today. Along the left-hand side, you'll see a few buttons, one of which says Go to Seminar, if you look all the way in the far upper left. If you'd like to join us for the live broadcast, you'll want to click on that Go to Seminar button, and when you do so, you'll be prompted to enter in your first name and last name, as well as the number of people at your location. And then you should be successfully checked in, and you'll join us in our live broadcast. For today's session, we'll be delivering the webinar using Adobe Connect, which will let you actually sit back and watch and listen as our presenters deliver their talks from various locations across the country. We'll actually be turning the page for you through the webinar, but if you have technical problems and are unable to join us through Adobe Connect, you can download copies of the presentation materials from our links or resources page and simply follow along on the phone. By default, audio is available online for all participants. That means you should be able to listen to this broadcast right through your computer or mobile device with a pair of speakers or a headphone. If you have problems with that online audio, check your local volume settings first. Sometimes it's a matter of increasing your speaker output in order to get it loud enough. If that doesn't solve the problem, we do have toll-free call-in information for those who need it. Simply use the Q&A window to request a call-in number, and I'll be more than happy to share that with you. Just know, if you're on the phone, you will be placed on a global mute, so you'll only be able to hear us. You won't be able to speak with us on the telephone line. Questions, comments, and technical problems can be privately submitted using the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen at any time. Feel free to test that out now if you'd like. To submit a message in, simply click your mouse cursor on the empty field at the very bottom of that Q&A window and type up your message. When you're done, hit the Enter key or press the cartoon bubble button, and that'll privately submit your message in. We will take a designated break after each presenter and try to go through as many questions as we can during their allotted slot on the agenda. We also have time at the end of today's session where we'll try to go through additional questions. There's no need to wait for those Q&A breaks, though. You can certainly submit the questions at any point, and I highly encourage you to type them up as soon as they occur to you so that we can build up a healthy question queue and try to get through as many questions as we can in the time allotted today. Today's session is being recorded, and we'll automatically send an email to all registered participants with that link to play back the recorded version of the webinar as soon as it's available. It usually takes us 1 to 2 weeks. You can feel free to forward that email on when you find it to anybody else that you think will find it a valuable expenditure of their time. And if you're interested, you can look at the nearly 600 previously recorded CLUIN webinars that we currently have on our archive. So just a visual reminder, you should see a copy of the slides here on the left portion of your screen. There's a button in the upper right corner of that window that looks like four arrows. If you click that button once, it'll make the slides bigger. That's an individual control. You can expand the slides as needed for your own viewing pleasure. If you want to shrink them back down, simply hover your mouse cursor on that same top level or top area of the slide window, and the bar will come back, and you can click that four arrow button again to shrink it down. You'll see information about the M2S2 group here in the upper right corner. The collection of related URLs in the middle right, those are all active hyperlinks, so click on any one of them and then press the Browse to button to open them up locally. And then, of course, our interactive Q&A window here in the lower right corner of your screen. Dwayne, I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today. So if you're prepared, go ahead and turn things over to you.
Absolutely. I appreciate it, Jean. And, well, first thing is, you know, I want to wish everyone a warm welcome to the FY15 M2S2 webinar series. You know, we're once again partnering with EPA's CLUIN folks, And I got to tell you, I couldn't be more tickled to again be working with Team Gene to produce these webinars. Today, December 10th, this is our first installment of the FY15 webinar series. You know, just a little Cliff Clavin trivia note about this day in history. Died on this day, still dead, back in 1896, Alfred Nobel passed away. And he was the inventor of dynamite, also the creator of the Nobel Peace Prize. So talk about a full-spectrum human being. And, you know, in a way, you might consider him as one of the founding fathers of our line of work. So rest in peace there, Alfred Nobel. Yeah, I included here on this slide a quote from the old Cary Grant movie, Arsenic and Old Lace. That's absolutely one of my favorite movies, and it's timelessly funny. You know, for our munitions response sites, everybody recognizes the kick that explosive hazards represent, but the chemicals that make up munitions, those can also provide some kick. And we need to be sure that we're appropriately investigating and remediating the munitions constituents as well as addressing the explosive hazards at our project sites. And really, that's what today's session is all about. Okay, and we're going to be conducting four M2S2 webinars in FY15. And in addition to today's munitions constituent session, on February 26th, we've got a seminar on advanced classification. Then on April 23rd, we have the session on planning. And June 23rd, we're going to conclude the FY15 webinar series with decision making. We haven't settled yet on the agendas for some of these upcoming sessions. So if you submitted an abstract, we do appreciate it. We are formulating the agendas. We'll let you know if your paper was selected as soon as we have the draft agendas. And, you know, if you haven't already, please be sure to register for any of the future sessions you're interested in, and also be sure to let your friends and colleagues know about them. Well, here's today's holiday parade lineup. We've got several great speakers and a very nice mix of perspectives on munitions constituents topics, and thanks to all of them for putting together their presentations, and also many thanks to Deb Walker for being my go-to person on all things MC and pulling the session together. Just a quick note about today's agenda. One of our speakers, Kelly Black, she was unable to join us, so we're going to be moving all of the speakers behind Kelly's presentation up one notch, and my apologies for the last-minute change, but we did have something unexpected that came up. As Gene mentioned, we do record and archive each of the M2S2 webinars, you know, and you don't even have to pay DirecTV or a cable company or Netflix or anybody to view them. You just look them up at this URL, and you can have yourself a New Year's M2S2 webinar marathon viewing. Now, you know, even though we've rounded up the abstracts for putting together this year's webinar series, we are always on the lookout for good topics and speakers. I like to keep a stable of potential presentations to draw upon. So, you know, if the brisk winter weather, if it makes you all excited and frisky like Musk at the Snow Dog, or if it makes you stir crazy where you feel like climbing a tree like Rosie the Hellcat here, you know, you could direct that energy into outlining a really cool presentation to share with our M2S2 audience, and just shoot me a message about that. We're always wanting to continue to drive home the message with our affected communities and our stakeholders that really the best way to help protect themselves from potential explosive hazards out there on our project sites is to follow the three R's of explosive safety: recognize, retreat, and report. And so with that, I believe we're ready to pull up our first speaker, and our first speaker is going to be Steve Rimbisch. Steve, to us from PARS, and I know that Steve worked very intimately with a lot of our MMRP site inspection projects. And Steve is he's a risk assessor and is going to be talking to us about identifying some of the chemicals of potential concern. So Steve, please take it away with your presentation.
Great, thank you. Wanted to just say that today what I'm speaking on is identification of chemicals of potential concern. So the subject of this talk is going to focus on, you've already decided that at a site you have to evaluate MC. So we already assume we're going to collect samples of environmental media. And how do you go from that point to identification of COPCs, which are going to be included into a risk assessment? So it's that portion of the project from those within those boundaries is the focus of today's talk. So first question, first, there we go. Oh, crud. Well, I just did exactly what I wasn't supposed to do, so someone else is going to have to steer the slides for me. I just closed the window when I went to click forward. So is someone, will someone
yep.
do that, please?
Steve, I've got you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. On the first slide, which is introduction, we want to talk about what we're going to talk about is how the chemicals of potential concern selection fits into the MMRP process. One thing to note, COPCs, I've seen a few different ways. I use chemicals of potential concern. I've seen constituents of potential concern. I've also seen contaminants of potential concern. So when I'm talking about COPCs, you can use whichever term you want. It's going to be all the same thing here. What we're going to talk about is initial development of the analyte list, how we come up with that, how we go through the process of identifying COPCs, some of the current issues we're running across working on these projects, and then some final thoughts. So if you can go to the next slide, please. One of the terms that we will use, and this is not is a non-standard term. We use it to help provide clarification. I've seen other people, other groups use other terms. We consider them preliminary COPCs, and these are anything that you feel is warranted to be on your analyte list. I've sometimes seen it's contaminants of interest is another term I've seen tossed around for this. These are selected based on your site knowledge, your understanding of the site, the known or suspected munitions and explosives of concern that are at the site, and any munitions debris. And this may come from historical records. It may come from other site inspections that have occurred. Whatever information you have, you can use to come up with your analyte list, your preliminary COPCs. And what you want to do is focus them on what you know to be at the site. We try not to just do a broad sweep of analysis for everything in the world. We want to focus it to the things that may be present at the site, and that would be indicative of a site-related release. We tailor to the site, especially with regards to metals, and we're starting to get some feedback that we should be tailoring it with regard to explosives as well, that you want to pay attention to what types of munitions were used at the site so that you can pick an appropriate analyte list. Generally, the analyte list is focused on explosives and metals because these are the main munitions constituents at a site. However, in some cases, it may be relevant to include PAHs, especially at at shotgun skeet ranges, or in some cases, we've also included BTEX compounds for sites where we know there was burn activities that may have been used diesel or gasoline as a fuel to start them. We try not to include essential nutrients in the analyte list. These are things that are assumed not to pose a risk to human health, but are or ecological risks, so we tend to keep them out of the analyte list. And those are generally calcium, iron, magnesium, potassium, and sodium, although iron can be up for discussion at a lot of times. There's issues with iron, and it really depends on the regulatory environment you're working in, whether you would include iron analysis or not. One of the things that we will always want to do is carefully evaluate the need for arsenic analysis. Arsenic can be very troublesome. It's not a common component of ordnance items. A major exception is shotgun shells, where it could show up as being present. But it is a soil component. It's naturally occurring, and it's usually present at concentrations that are well above screening values. And so it can be very problematic, and a lot of times it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to try to pursue arsenic. If you can go to the next slide, please. Some of the things to consider as well, and these are some special considerations. Analyte lists at small arms ranges usually are focused on the small arms munitions indicator metals, and these are antimony, copper, lead, and zinc. These are the primary metal components of small arms ammunition. And so we try to focus our analysis on those metals. It's hard to imagine a scenario where you would find some of the metals that are maybe present at trace concentrations and not find these metals. Thus, this looking for contaminants, we would focus on these metals. At times, at the firing lines, we will also look at explosives. Usually this would be as a result, you would look at in front of the firing line and see if there's any explosives residue that may have come out of the guns when they were being fired. And a lot of times at skeet ranges, we will look at PAHs. These are not technically a munitions constituent because not a part of the ammunition used at the skeet range, but they are a component of the clay pigeons that would be used, especially the older skeet ranges. They were used, and the tar was used as binders to make the clay pigeons, and so you can get pretty high concentrations of PAHs associated with skeet ranges. And the other special case that we'll run into sometimes are burn pits. You would get potential for PAHs as well, and as I mentioned before, sometimes BTEX compounds or even some other VOCs that may be present or may have been used at some point. So once you've identified your analyte list or identified your preliminary COPCs, you go out, you collect your samples, you then take the analytical results and you use that to identify what your COPCs are going to be. If you can go to the next slide, it says identification of COPCs. There's essentially a couple phases of this comparison that you do. What we usually do is compare our metals concentrations to a selected background concentration. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. And additionally, we will take our analytical results, and it says other preliminary COPCs, but that should include all preliminary COPCs that are detected greater than your preliminary screening values. And preliminary screening values are a process we use to rule out further evaluation of some of the things that are not anticipated to pose a risk. So these are things that are well below either the human health or the selected ecological screening values. A lot of times we'll use EPA's regional screening levels, which are updated twice a year and are generally accepted as a good protective screening level. Other times we'll use state screening levels if a state has them, and again, that really depends on the regulatory environment. Most of the time, what we'll do is we'll compare the human health and the ecological screening values and use the lower of the two to make the decision about whether an analyte will be retained into the risk assessment. And again, I'm not going to get into much what you do with it once you've identified it as a COPC that needs to be evaluated in the risk assessment. This is just getting to that point. And the reason we'll compare the human health and ecological is that if it's below both the human health and the ecological screening values, which essentially it is if you're using the lower of the two, then you can rule it out and say that it's not likely to pose a risk to either human health or ecological receptors. So if you can go to this next slide, which is comparison to background. So one of the things that occurs is because metals are a main munitions constituent, we're dealing a lot of times with concentrations that may or may not be reflective of naturally occurring concentrations. So when we collect our biased samples, and by whatever method you're collecting your samples, we compare them to the sites, selected site-specific background concentrations, looking for any exceedances of background. There's other preliminary COPCs that also can be present due to non-military anthropogenic sources. These are primarily the PAHs. And if you're looking for PAHs, you may also want to collect background samples for PAHs so that you can compare those to see if a potential release has occurred as a result of your munitions-related activities. PAHs have a lot of other sources. They are naturally occurring as a result of any kind of burning of organic material. You can generate PAHs, so these would be forest fires, grass fires, anything along those lines can increase the concentrations of PAHs. If you're collecting from near asphalt roads or runways or in the runoff pathways from those, you can have very high concentrations of PAHs. And then if you just have regional industrial emissions, especially we're finding up in the Northeast where you have had a lot of old coal burning activities, essentially you can have high PAH concentrations. So you want to be considering those as you do this comparison. One of the current issues we're running across, and this varies depending on your regulatory environment and who you're dealing with, is can analytes present at concentrations less than background be removed from further consideration? Let me go to the next slide. That is a question that we're currently working through on a number of sites, and I just wanted to take this opportunity to put it out there as something to consider as you're working through these projects. If you look at different guidance documents, if you look at the DIRP manual, it specifically states that risk assessments should not quantify exposure to naturally occurring substances present at concentrations unaffected by current or past site activities. The interpretation of that is that if you have analytes, metals, PAHs, that are present at concentrations less than background, that you would not include those in the risk assessment, that they would not be considered COPCs, they would not be considered evidence of contamination, and would not be evaluated in the risk assessment. If you're looking at different state guidance, you have guidance from different states can lead you in different directions as well about how you deal with analytes that are present below background concentrations. The next slide under current issues, the tri-service position paper, is similar to the DIRP manual. Basically, it describes the consideration of background levels as a clear understanding of the chemicals released from a site, and site background conditions is an important aspect of this approach. So basically, it indicates that you should compare your site concentrations to risk-based screening levels, which would be the US EPA's RSLs, for example. The site chemical concentration should also be compared to background concentrations. And chemicals that are above the risk-based screening level and the background levels are identified as site-related COPCs and would be evaluated in the risk assessment. And the last bullet, that chemicals are above risk-based screening levels but below background levels, identified as non-site-related COPCs, but they're really you're indicating that they're not present as contamination, and therefore these would not be evaluated in the risk assessment at that point. Now the issue becomes at some sites you have. If you go to the next slide where it says EPA guidance. EPA's guidance for comparing background and chemical concentrations in soil for surplus sites essentially tells you to do the opposite of that. This policy, it says there in the bullet, this policy recommends a baseline risk assessment approach that retains constituents that exceed risk-based screening concentrations and involves addressing site-specific background issues at the end of the risk assessment in the risk characterization. And the next sentence after that in EPA's guidance is that when concentrations of naturally occurring elements at a site exceed risk-based screening levels, that information should be discussed qualitatively in the risk characterization. So essentially what you have apparently is conflicting guidance on what you do with chemicals that exceed background that exceed screening levels but do not exceed background. So what's interesting we find is that both sets of guidance documents refer to the same statements and interpret them differently. So we're actually in the process right now of trying to reconcile those differences at a couple sites. And unfortunately, I don't have any wonderful resolution to it at this stage yet. Just wanted to raise it as a potential issue. If you go to some of our final thoughts. So the main way of addressing some of these concerns and some of these issues are trying to get early team discussion and concurrence on some of these what could be contentious issues if you let it go too far into the process. This is just echoing the importance of conducting TPP meetings with all the stakeholders and all the decision makers present so that you can agree or gain concurrence as much as possible on these issues so that when it comes to the stage of doing the risk assessment, the data is usable for the risk assessment, that everybody agrees on what will be included in the risk assessment or not included in a risk assessment. And so these include these issues that should be addressed early on in the process include things like identification of your analyte lists and, as well, identification of appropriate MDLs for it. I didn't touch on that issue at all, but just making sure that you've identified project action limits that will analytical methods that will meet your project action limits as best as possible. There's differences on the use of PSVs depending on that may be site-specific and, again, may depend on the regulatory environment. These are your preliminary screening values and how you use those. So in some situations, you can combine and use the lowest of the human health and the ecological screening values. Other regulatory environments, they want you to keep those separate and do separate evaluations for those and develop a set of human health COPCs and a set of chemicals of potential ecological concern separately. And it's good to know that up front before you generate a risk assessment that then has to be redone because there's disagreement on the approach. And then finally, the other main issue is I discuss how background comparison will be done and when in the process it will be done. So is this background comparison something that is done as part of the identification of COPCs so that you compare to preliminary screening values and background concentrations and only retain those analytes that are present at concentrations greater than both? Or is comparison to background concentrations something that occurs following the risk assessment? So you would use screening values to identify your COPCs and then take your COPCs and calculate human health and ecological risks, and then following that calculation you would then compare to background concentrations and identify those, the contribution of background. So basically it would provide a risk estimate that includes things that may be naturally occurring. However, you then discuss that in the uncertainty and in the risk management portions of the risk assessment. And the other big issue is just the methods of comparison. What statistical methods you would use, or how you're going to use site concentrations and background concentrations to determine what is present at concentrations that would be considered greater than background. Not always a straightforward question. So I appreciate it. That's my presentation. I'm available for questions.
Okay. Very good, Steve. Excellent information. We did have a couple of questions that came in, and one of them was there, and you touched on this a little bit, but the preliminary screening values, those don't exist for a lot of munitions constituents. And so, you know, would you care to elaborate a little bit, or, you know, have a suggestion for your approach on developing those screening values, or how do you tackle that?
Well, they actually, if you're picking your analyte list, I mean, if you're focused on metals and explosives, there are preliminary screening values, at least for soil and groundwater, for most of those. There's only a couple that you don't have published screening values for. And okay. So we've had good success at finding screening values either from EPA or from states for most of those. You can get in now if you're talking about chemical agent. Yeah, that can get difficult to find appropriate screening values. But for generally for your explosive suite and your metal suite, you can find them.
So most of the traditional munitions constituents, with a little research, you've been able to root around and find something?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Very good. Another question we have is, do you have any experience in including soil to groundwater screening criteria for explosives? What do you know about that?
That is something that you would really want to negotiate with your TPP team early on in the process of how you're going to incorporate that pathway. In some scenarios, if you feel like groundwater may or may not have been affected, in some regulatory environments, if you sample the groundwater directly, you don't have to worry so much about looking at the soil to groundwater transport pathway if you're just going to go ahead and sample groundwater. In other scenarios, you want to make sure you're comparing to those. There's usually you can find similarly screening values for soil that are protective of groundwater, and if you raise the discussion early on about what are you going to use for PSVs, then you can include those in your potential PSVs and conduct that evaluation early on. And in those cases, then, instead of just a direct contact human health and an ecological screening value, you would have three potential values to choose from, and so your third one would be your protection of groundwater value.
Okay.
And generally, we generally, at least at the early stages, are just using published screening values and not really going into any kind of site-specific consideration at that point. We try to use the published generic screening values. That way they're conservative and protective, and you can usually get good agreement among stakeholders about the published values.
Okay, very good. We had another question. Okay, well, actually, that's not even a question. It's really more of a statement, but I'll solicit your thoughts on that. We had someone who made the observation that, you know, the essential nutrients, that even those, they can be toxic at sufficient doses. And so, you know, really, don't you kind of need another reason to exclude those from the analysis rather than just saying that they are essential nutrients?
Well, first of all, they're yes, they can. Everything can be toxic at sufficient doses. For calcium, sodium, magnesium, and potassium, EPA has not published screening values for those, so there's not really a comparison value that you could even really compare to. The concentrations that would be toxic are sufficiently high, and in theory, at least, what we try to do is focus. You know, there's other more toxic metals that would be present if you were evaluating that the metals pathways that would show up as well, so that you would focus your investigation on those that are going to pose the greatest risk.
Right. Okay.
In a scenario, if the argument is that you want to use those as indications of a potential release, then they can, you know, then that can be considered as a potential for analysis. For example, if you know that you want to look for potassium, for example, or sodium, for example, as indicative of you know that something, some of the munitions activities conducted at a site may have released either, you know, high levels of potassium or sodium or something, then, yeah, then it may make sense to include those in the analytical suite just to use as a, to try to identify or to try to delineate contamination. But from a risk perspective, they're still not going to be, they won't be included in a risk assessment. There's no toxicity values for those.
Right. Okay, that makes sense to me. Are there any vapor intrusion issues associated with explosives?
Generally not. They're not very volatile compounds. And so that's not an issue that we tend to pursue. Now, if you're at a scenario, again, where you feel, and again, this is not, I'm not talking chemical agent here. So that would be a slightly different scenario if you're dealing with agent. But your explosive suite are not very volatile. They're not going to, that's not a pathway that we generally consider as a complete exposure pathway.
Okay.
If you find a site where you had VOCs present for some reason, such as, again, it was a fuel component that was used at a burn pit and may not have burned off, or maybe dank that was present at a chemical site, that then maybe you may want to consider the possibility of vapor intrusion, but routinely, no.
Okay. What about the relationship between identifying the chemicals of potential concern and the conceptual site model? Could you talk about that just a little bit?
Yes, you can. Now, that is definitely something you want to consider. You want to generate a conceptual site model also early in the process. Your conceptual site model will help drive a couple things. One, it'll help drive what media and where you sample. For example, a small arms range, you know, if you know your release mechanism, you're going to want to sample in the berms and in front of the firing points. For a burn pit, you're going to want to make sure, you know, sampling surface soil at a burn pit that's been backfilled isn't probably going to give you a whole lot of useful information. So the conceptual site model there will help drive your investigation. You also, when you're identifying PSVs, when your preliminary screening values, you want to understand current and future land use as well. If you have a site that is currently undeveloped and someone's looking at it for potential residential development, that's going to drive your selection of your PSVs from a human health standpoint. You're going to definitely want to use your residential screening values. If you have a site that is open space or current, you know, being planned for some sort of industrial development, then you may not want to use the residential screening criteria. You may want to use the commercial industrial screening criteria. Similarly, if you have a site that's going to be maintained as a park or open space or a some sort of wildlife sanctuary, then your selection of ecological screening values is very different than if you have a site that would be again, in, you know, being planned or already developed for resident or for residential or industrial development. Then you may not want to worry about ecological screening values at a site that's already fully developed. So yes, the conceptual site model should be developed early on and used to help identify what PSVs you're going to use.
Okay, very good. I think we have time for just one more quick question, Steve. When your munitions site is, when it's one of the munitions manufacturing facilities, how do you separate the MCs from the manufacturing chemicals, you know, the solvents and whatever may be used as part of the manufacturing process?
That's a good question. It becomes much more difficult. I mean, most of my sites have been that I've worked on, I haven't had that issue. So I haven't really had to address that very much. It's just an understanding of process knowledge and your regulatory environment. I think that would be a question I would go to somebody like you, Duane, and say, you know, what program is that covered under? And if we're investigating it, then you just include all of the potential chemicals that could have been released and evaluate it. Now, where it gets hard is some of the sites where we have a range that is potentially underlain by a TCE groundwater plume that came from a different source, because now you're dealing with, at least from the government standpoint, two different programs. And so you have to make that distinction. But mostly it comes from understanding the process and trying to get as much information as you can ahead of time about what may have been done at the manufacturing versus, you know, if you have a potential range that you're dealing with and trying to deal with separately.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Once again, I would tie it back into developing a robust conceptual site model.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Steve, I very much appreciate it. We're out of time for your material, but there may be additional questions that pop up that we want to tackle at the end of the session. So again,
Great. Excellent
information. Very much appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Our next speaker is Mr. Jay Clawson, and Jay is with the Corps of Engineers, and he actually he works up at our engineering lab, or up at our Cold Regions lab, as part of the Engineer Research and Development Center up in New Hampshire. And Jay has a ton of experience on incremental sampling methodologies, and so Jay was willing to put together a presentation about fate of munitions constituents on some of our ranges. So, Jay, please, the floor is yours.
All right, thanks, Dwayne. So, as Dwayne indicated, I'm going to be talking about the fate of munition constituents, MC, on military ranges. So, first we want to start off and go through what are the MCs used by the military, and I've broken them out by a variety of categories. And I have, under each category, the compounds listed by their prevalence of usage in the various types of munitions. And then those compounds that are highlighted in bold, those are the ones that I'll be talking about in terms of their fate. So in regards to propellants, you know, the principal compounds are nitrocellulose, nitroglycerin, and then 2,4-dinitrotoluene. The use of nitroguanidine and ethyl centrolite is a lot less frequent. There's only a few munitions that use those constituents. In regards to the explosives, the primary ones are RDX, TNT, and HMX. Ammonium picrate is used in some of the older formulations. Tetryl was used up until about the 1950s. It's not used in any present formulations. And then PETN is used in detonation cord. In regards to the pyrotechnics, we have perchlorate that could be included under explosives because it's also used in spotting charges for some artillery rounds, as well as under the propellants because it's used as fuel for rockets. And also I've included under pyrotechnics white phosphorus. It's used in a few cases as a substitution for the explosive filler. And then we have a variety of metals, principally as salts, depending on the pyrotechnic device. In terms of the projectiles themselves, most of them are composed out of metal, and so there are various metals in the outer casing materials, and then oftentimes there's a slug or a core of more dense metal, usually lead or tungsten or some alloy of those. And then finally, the fillers, the phthalates, which are principally associated with propellants, as well as the diethylamine. And then PCNs are sometimes used, they're an impurity in the wax that's sometimes used as a substitute for a filler in explosives charge. So those are typically used as training-type devices. So the MCs share some general physical and chemical properties. Most of these compounds are solids at environmental temperatures. They're typically deposited on ranges as particulates onto the soil surface itself. And then the contamination of this material can persist for long periods of time. In the case of the metals, you're talking hundreds of years of persistence, and more so if you're in an arid type of environment. Most of the MCs have absorption or dissolution dependencies. And then point out the fact that some of the propellant residues can consist of discrete fibers, unlike some of the explosives that are actually crystalline chunks or particulates. And then the metals can be in the form of the metallic form or as salts. So what I'm presenting today is based on a number of field studies that we've conducted over the last couple of decades at a variety of sites throughout the U.S. and Canada. But it also includes those activities under the MMRP program that the EMCX is involved with, too. So I've looked at that information as well and kind of incorporated all the information together. So what we've found in soils, this is kind of a conglomeration of data from a variety of sites, but principally what we've seen are the N-nitroso-diphenylamine, which is a transformation product of diphenylamine, phthalates, ethyl centrolite, and dinitrotoluenes. Those are all associated with propellant formulations. And then the next grouping of compounds we typically see are RDX, HMX, TNT, and the amino dinitrotoluenes and the diamino nitrotoluenes. And the amino and the diaminos are transformation products of TNT. And then finally, we see some nitroglycerin, some perchlorate, and a few other compounds. And the reason I want to show that and then place this in context with what we've seen in groundwater, this is data from Camp Edwards in Massachusetts, is that you see quite a bit different listing of the MC. So in groundwater, we've seen RDX and HMX and perchlorate, and that's telling you something about the fate and the transport properties of these compounds. We don't see a lot of TNT, and we see some frequency of the amino dinitrotoluenes. And then we don't typically see much in regards to the DNTs. In fact, I think most of this data is associated with 2,6-DNT, and at least in my mind, I believe a lot of that is false positives. And then there are a few detects of other compounds, and again, I think a lot of those may have been false positives, although we couldn't necessarily prove that that was the case. So I wanted to break out the MC distribution a little bit by range activity because the MCs that you're going to expect to find are largely a function of what munition item is being used. So there are differences depending on the types of munitions and then whether you're in an impact area or at a firing point. So with the artillery and mortar impact areas, you can anticipate to find RDX, HMX, TNT, the transformation products of TNT, and then possibly perchlorate. And then at the firing positions, you're going to see potentially the DNTs, the nitrocellulose, maybe some nitroguanidine or ethyl centrolite, and then a variety of phthalates, and then possibly the N-nitroso compound. You'll see a similar mix of compounds at the rocket target as you would at the artillery mortar impact area, RDX, HMX, TNT, possibly the aminos, and then maybe some nitroglycerin, depending on whether the rocket consumed the full complement of propellant before it reached the target. And then at the firing point, nitroglycerin, nitrocellulose, and ethyl centrolite are all possibilities. A little bit different on the small arms firing ranges. At the firing point, you'll see the propellants, potentially nitroglycerin and DNT, and then possibly lead. Lead stephanate is used in some primers. And then in the impact area, you're principally going to see lead, zinc, copper, antimony, and possibly tungsten, whether or not they use the tungsten round. The demolition area is a little bit different. It really depends on what they're blowing up. So you have potential explosives, metals, possibly PAHs, perchlorate, maybe PCNs, and then dioxins, primarily a function of whether they're, burning paper or plastics and that sort of thing. And then the weapons test ranges, again, are really dependent on what types of systems they're testing. But explosives, metals, perchlorate, and possibly PCNs are all possibilities. So let's start in and talk a little bit about the fate of some particular compounds. So I've lumped RDX and HMX together because they have similar properties. The mechanism of the release is as particulates in a heterogeneous manner. And dissolution is the key transport mechanism. You have to get this material in solution in order for it to move. Both these compounds dissolve slowly, but once in solution, they rapidly migrate to groundwater. They're essentially recalcitrant, which means they really don't have any natural biotic, abiotic, or phototransformation processes that function effectively. You might have some minimal processes of these activities occurring, but by and large, it's not taking place. Once in solution, RDX and HMX don't significantly absorb to the soil surface, so very little soil contamination remains. If you go into the literature for RDX, the absorption or the KD number is typically less than 7 liters per kilogram for a variety of soil types. So that really shows that that material is not going to have a tendency to stick to soil. And then one other observation is typically what little RDX and HMX is getting into the solution phase and being transported through the vadosome, that pore water concentration is very small mass-wise in terms of the total soil mass. So that's one of the reasons why if you do subsurface soil sampling, you're oftentimes not going to see any RDX or HMX contamination. The other principal explosive compound is 2,4-6 trinitrotoluene, or TNT, and the transformation products that are associated with that are principally the amino dinitrotoluenes. There is an intermediate product, the diamino nitrotoluenes, and they have similar properties as well. Again, we have this heterogeneous release of contaminants into the environment. Unlike the RDX and HMX, the TNT is rapidly dissolved. And then once in solution, dissolution, absorption are the two key transport mechanisms. So you got to get the material in solution, and then once it's in solution, there's a tendency to absorb onto a variety of soil surfaces. And so TNT and the amino dinitrotoluenes are not quite as absorptive as nitroglycerin and DNT, but much more so than RDX, HMX, and perchlorate. Transformation is the key fate mechanism for TNT. So TNT transforms to the DANTs, the diaminos, and then that transforms to the 2A and the 4A, or the amino dinitrotoluenes. So those are the two important isomers, and you typically see those in about equal abundance. So there are photomediated, abiotic, and biotic processes, all that are important for transformation. It really just depends on the conditions at your site. And again, typically there's not a whole lot of material that's going into solution, so if you're doing subsurface soil sampling, you'd have a tendency not to see the TNT and the aminos in the subsurface soil. You have a better chance because the TNT and the aminos absorb to soil a little bit better than the RDX on the HMX, but my experience has been it's oftentimes difficult to see this material in the subsurface. And principally that's because on the surface you have large chunks of material that are being collected in your sample, and so you get a high concentration. Whereas you get down in the subsurface, you don't have chunks of material, below a foot or so. Talk a little bit about perchlorate. Again, it has a heterogeneous release. I included it here because it's oftentimes used as a replacement for the explosive filler as a spotting charge. And so perchlorate dissolution is the key transport mechanism. You want to get it into solution, but once it's in solution, it goes. It rapidly dissolves. Perchlorate has a high solubility. For example, the ammonium perchlorate has a solubility of 200,000 milligrams per liter. So once this material dissolves, it rapidly migrates through the vadosome to groundwater if it exists at your site. The perchlorate is recalcitrant. There are limited abiotic and biotransformation processes, and absorption is minimal. So once the perchlorate is deposited on the soil surface, if you have any sort of precipitation event, all that material goes into solution and is quickly transported away from the surface. So if you're going to do any sort of surface soil sampling, typically little residual soil contamination remains unless you're able to get out there immediately after it's been deposited. And again, you have this difficulty of detecting perchlorate in the subsurface soil due to the low concentration of material relative to the total soil mass. You can see the perchlorate, the RDX, HMX, and the TNT if you were to install tension lysimeters, but most people don't install those types of devices. So switch gears a little bit here away from the explosives and now switch to the propellants. Dinitrotoluene is a principal one. The two isomers of interest are 2,4 and 2,6. There are about five other isomers, but the percentage in propellant is essentially insignificant, so we typically don't focus in on those. Again, you have a heterogeneous release into the environment, and dissolution is the key transport mechanism. DNT is rapidly dissolved from the surface, but with a little caveat here in that the propellant formulations typically have nitrocellulose, and nitrocellulose tends to make up the majority of the mass of the material in the propellant. And the DNT is on the surface of this nitrocellulose material, but it's also embedded within the nitrocellulose itself. And so what we see is the nitro, or the DNT on the surface of the nitrocellulose is rapidly dissolved and goes into solution, but the material that's inside the nitrocellulose, the DNT is rate limited in terms of diffusion of getting out of there. So essentially, if that surface DNT is removed and is gone, the DNT that remains is essentially locked up in the nitrocellulose. It's not available for biotransformation processes, and it's not available for transport. And we've done a number of experiments to look at that. You know, you do, when you apply 8330 method to analyze your soil, you do see DNT, and that's because the solvent, acetonitrile or the acetone, can get into the nitrocellulose and pull out that DNT. But if you do some experiments with deionized water, or we've tried some different types of surfactants, you cannot get that DNT out. It's essentially locked in place. But once the DNT does get into solution, transformation is the key fate variable, followed by soil absorption. And DNT is highly susceptible to biotransformation and phototransformation processes, and maybe less so clear on whether abiotic processes are important. And if those processes don't transform the DNT, then there are a variety of soils that have strong absorption capacities to basically stop the DNT from moving. So we've done some soil profiling, we have installed lysimeters, and we have looked at groundwater data. They all indicate that the DNTs have minimal transport. Typically, it's less than a meter of movement. You might, depending on your soil conditions, maybe get a little greater movement than that. But typically, we don't see groundwater impacts. Nitroglycerin is similar to the DNT. Again, the mechanism release is the same. Dissolution is the key transport variable again. And you have the same mechanism in regards to nitroglycerin being manufactured with nitrocellulose. And so the material that's on the surface of the nitrocellulose gets released rapidly. But the material that's inside the nitrocellulose is basically unavailable for biotransformation processes, and it's not available to be dissolved and transported. If you do get the NG into solution, just like the DNTs, they're highly susceptible to biotransformation processes as well as phototransformation, and then they're strongly absorbed onto soil. And just as the case was with DNT, the nitroglycerin exhibits mineral transport, primarily due to the transformation and the absorption processes. Oh, I just lost my slides, but I have my backups. So one thing you'll note on the slide is that the solubility of nitroglycerin shown here is 1,250 milligrams per liter, which is fairly high, but not as high as perchlorate. And the reason I point this out is oftentimes I've seen people do modeling for transport using the conditions of the soil at the site, inputting a KD variable, what have you. but then ignoring any transformation processes, and that model output suggests migration of nitroglycerin. And that typically is not going to occur due to the transformation processes. Gene, I'm going to need you to advance the slides for me.
Absolutely.
Lost that. Hang on, maybe I have it. Oh, there it is. Okay. I just accidentally switched screens. So this is some data from a field site in Massachusetts. The red bar chart in the background is for a sample collected in 2005. I think this is 9 different samples. And we see about 20 parts per million of nitroglycerin in the soil. And then that sample was collected immediately following firing activities. And then once we collected that sample, firing was ceased. And we went back and we sampled 2 years later. And you can see the concentrations in the soil have decreased in those blue bars by about 50 to 60%. So that's clearly indicative of the transformation processes occurring in the soil. And I suspect if we had gone back out there, you know, at a later date, the concentrations would have been even lower. So we'll talk a little bit about white phosphorus. Again, sometimes it's used as a different filler in your projectile, and it behaves quite a bit differently than the other materials. So if this material is introduced out into the environment, it's rapidly oxidized on the soil surface. It basically undergoes spontaneous combustion, and consequently it's not persistent because basically it will just consume itself. However, if you fired around and impacted into a swamp or a wetland and you had anoxic and reducing sediments, under those conditions the white phosphorus will not spontaneously combust and it will not dissolve, and so basically it just sits there. It's really not transportable. The issue has been with white phosphorus that in some shallow swamps or wetland type environments, you have some waterfowl that like to use sediment as grit for their digestion of material of their food, and they can't differentiate between natural sediment and maybe some white phosphorus chunks that's sitting there on the sediment. And white phosphorus is highly toxic. So now let's switch a little bit away from the energetic materials and talk a little bit about metallic residues. There's been more interest in this in the last few years. So the presentation is primarily focused on small arms ranges in that that's what we've most extensively studied in regards to metals. Be aware, though, that you know metals are used in the outer casing materials of artillery, mortars, grenades, rockets, and so you potentially have those materials out in the impact area. The principal material in small arms ammunition is lead, which is in the slug. And the key fate mechanism is dissolution, precipitation reactions, and then followed by absorption, desorption reactions. I will emphasize under most geochemical regimes, lead is not mobile. And that's probably contrary to what you may have heard. But I think a lot of times people get confused with aqueous forms of lead that have been released in the environment and then just contribute those properties to metallic lead released in the environment. And the two do not behave the in any shape, way, or form the same. Once metallic lead is released in the environment, it oxidizes and essentially forms insoluble lead carbonates and sulfates, such as cerussite or hydrocerussite or anglite or some others. If you do get a form of lead in solution, it's usually the Pb2+, and whether or not that forms is a function of the redox conditions, the pH of precipitation, and as well as then the redox pH and geochemical conditions of your pore water and your soils, and that will determine how much movement occurs. The dissolved form of lead, the Pb2+, can be scavenged by iron and magnesium oxides and oxyhydroxides. And I've done an extensive review of groundwater or potential groundwater impacts due to lead ammunition, and there is no evidence of groundwater impacts. essentially the lead is immobilized by these precipitation reactions. And it does move to some degree, but we're just talking a few feet or a few meters in the ground surface. So groundwater impacts, I haven't seen any documentation that occurs. So this is some data of lead in soil pore water. So we installed a number of these tension lysimeters at a couple different berms. The site was in Georgia. And we also installed some lysimeters at the firing points. And for the berm samples, the lead concentration in the soil ranged from 10,000 to about 100,000 parts per million. And then we do see lead in the soil pore water, but as you increase in depth, the concentration of lead decreases. And we've seen this at other sites as well. So, you know, by a meter or two, pretty much all the lead in the soil pore water is gone. And we have installed monitoring wells at a number of sites, and we do not see any lead contamination in the groundwater. Show a little bit of data on soil in terms of the metals. A similar profile, you see copper, lead, and tungsten here on the left. And the concentrations are relatively high in the surface soil, but then they decrease with increasing depth. And then I showed the antimony and the zinc over on the right side, just because the concentrations that we've seen are quite a bit lower. And that's primarily a function of the fact that there's not a lot of this material in the small arms ammunition. So antimony is added as a hardening agent to the lead, and then the zinc is a mixture or element added to the copper alloy material. And then tungsten is potentially a substitute for lead in some munition items, although that has been phased out, at least in the small arms, the 5.56 bullet. We'll talk a little bit about tungsten. It exists in a variety of oxidation states. The most important is the plus 6. Interestingly, metallic tungsten rapidly oxidizes. I did some experiments in a lab, and we're talking about hours. If you have a powdered tungsten, it's totally oxidized. There's no metallic material remaining, which is quite interesting. The tungsten can form complex ions of polytungstates, or I included here, but tungstates. And the polytungstates have a subvariety referred to as a polyoxymetallate, or a POM, and that forms in low pH environments. So in terms of tungsten's mobility, tungstate's the highest, has the highest mobility, followed by polytungstate, this subgroup, this POM, the tungsten oxide, and then metallic tungsten essentially does not move. Tungstate is... Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to wrap real briefly, just mention that we've only got a couple of minutes left in this time slot, Jay, so we need to be wrapping it up. Okay.
Yep. So tungstate undergoes polymerization and basically changes to polytungstate. And so typically, you know, tungstate movement is limited. And if you have a mobile form, it's usually the polytungstate type form. And the tungstate also can be absorbed out of the soil or onto the soil surfaces of iron oxides like ferry hydrate. So the most prevalent form of oxidized tungsten to the surface appears to be the polytungstates. And you can get these forms, these POMs. They're large complex molecules. They're relatively stable, and they don't migrate. So kind of touched on different MCs, and I've broken them out by distribution, by range activity. All of them, depending on their munition type, can be found in the surface soils. And then what you see is that there's a difference with groundwater. I won't go into this specifically, but the difference is due to the transformation and absorption potential of these different compounds depending on the soil matrix you have. So in terms of conclusions, in regards to the energetics, you know, the mobility potential is greatest for HMX RDX perchlorate. And I included tungsten here. It's much greater than the amino dinitrotoluenes, the TNT, and the antimony. And then less transport capability for the ethyl centrolite nitroglycerin and the DNTs, and then essentially lead, the PCNs, the white phosphorus, are immobile. So to recap, RDX and HMX are slowly dissolved. They're not absorbed to soil surfaces. They're unreactive, and consequently, they rapidly migrate through soil and groundwater. And perchlorate is pretty much the same, although it's more rapidly leached into solution than the RDX and HMX. So all three of those compounds, RDX, HMX, and perchlorate, can be expected in groundwater, you know, where they have munitions containing those compounds. The one exception might be an environment where you have little precipitation. The TNT and the amino dinitrotoluenes can be present in soil and potentially present in groundwater, but mobility is limited by transformation and absorption processes. And then the same is true for the DNTs and the nitroglycerin, although its potential in groundwater is even less than the TNT and the amino dinitrotoluenes. And then the last slide, just talking a little bit about the metals fate in transport. Primarily, it's the geochemical conditions of the soil and the soil pore water that control whether or not you're going to get movement of and a formation and the movement of subsequent metal species. Some metals are dissolved, and we do see them in the soil pore water, but its movement is really dependent on the speciation that forms. And we typically see the highest concentrations of the soil pore water at the surface and increase with depth, and we see the same thing in the soil as well. So in terms of mobility, the tungsten has the highest mobility potential, followed by antimony, then zinc, copper, and lead is the least mobile. In fact, we haven't really seen any evidence of movement of lead other than a few feet beneath the source term. And then the following couple of slides are just some reference material if folks are interested in following up in specific MCs. And that's it.
Excellent. A lot of very valuable information there, Jay. Very much appreciated. Now, I have a handful of questions that came in, but we'll try to tackle those at the end of the session. So if you don't mind sticking around, we would appreciate it.
Very good.
Okay. Excellent. Our next speakers, they actually come to us from the far-flung reaches of the country out in Hawaii. And we have Steve Mao and Roger Brewer with the Hawaii Department of Health. They're going to talk to us about incremental sampling. And Steve, he's got a lot of experience working with munition sites. And Roger actually helped write the state's guidance on incremental sampling. So with that, I'm going to let them give us the state's perspective on incremental sampling.
Hey, thanks, Dwayne. So aloha and good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are. So this is Roger, by the way. So I'm going to go over real quickly just an overview of problems with discrete samples. We've been looking at this for several years now. And then a quick overview of what decision units are in incremental sampling, and then go through some examples. One thing to point out with incremental sampling, the Army Corps has been one of the leads on this for the last 10 or 20 or more years. And there's several people, several of the speakers, Ed Quirrell, Jay Clawson, Kelly Black, who isn't here, they were on ITRC's incremental sampling team. Let's see. So I was trying to move the slides, and I'm not getting them. Let's try this. There we go. Okay, the key references, if you really want to know about sampling theory, Francis Pittard's book, Pierre Guy's Sampling Theory and Sampling Practice. It is a great book to get into the details. The ITRC published in 2012 an incremental sampling methodology. It's a great overview of incremental sampling and then an introduction to how to do incremental sampling in the field. And for field implementation, our office published a technical guidance manual, and we go into more details on how to actually implement incremental sampling in the field. Training courses, I think over 3,000 people have joined in ITRC's incremental sampling methodology webinars. It's pretty amazing. I bet a lot of people online here have done that also. Definitely worthwhile doing. They teach it quarterly. It's in two parts. If you want to get into the more details on incremental sampling or multi-increment sampling, as Chuck Ramsey calls it, he teaches a four-day class. He comes out to Hawaii regularly. And if you really want to get into details of sampling theory, check out Francis Pittard's class. I think he teaches that in Colorado. So here's, let me go through a quick example. Here's a typical, say, setup for a discrete sample, something we might have done 10 or 15 years ago. Say at this site you suspect some type of contamination, PCBs, arsenic, or munitions, or whatever. So you collect, this would be a lot of discrete samples, I think 25 or so. So you collect discrete samples, maybe do a few step outs. Red means it's above your screening level. Yellow is something there, but below. Green is clean. And you get something like this. So you outline the areas that appear to be contaminated and set up your soil excavation plan. Then notice this kind of strange cold spot within the contaminated area and an isolated hot spot. Keep those in mind because they're important. And then you go out to the site and you dig up everything and collect confirmation samples. Where here the red dots indicate where your confirmation samples failed, kind of surprisingly. So this is very common at sites. So what's going on here? So what's going on? Why do we have to remobilize so many times to go out and characterize the site, determine the extent of contamination? Real commonly, you start off with a small excavation and end up with something really huge. You can have a failed in-situ remediation. We had a good example of that here for benzene, where initial estimates based on discrete soil sample data suggested 5 tons of benzene in the ground. It took out 30 tons with an SVE system, went under bankrupt-wise, and then estimated mass after better sampling, 75 tons. These are all real common problems we see in the field. What's going on here, back to the excavation, if you look over in the right-hand that colorful box there, it's really all comes down to small-scale, high variability of contaminant concentrations over a few inches of feet. Now, put PCBs in here, but it could be anything. It could be RDX or whatever. So that box just represents all the different potential concentrations above or below screening levels that you could get in a discrete sample within just a few centimeters or a meter or so within one area. So here's something we thought about. Have you ever wondered what if you, collecting discrete samples, what if you moved your discrete sample point over a few feet? And what if the lab tested a different pinch or a spoonful of soil out of the jar, samples or jar you sent to them? Well, we thought about that too. We just finished up a study this year where we looked at decision error associated with the use of discrete sample soil data. So we went out to three different sites and collected and tested hundreds of discrete samples side by side or across the grid at each site for arsenic, lead, and the third site was PCBs. The arsenic site, we didn't expect much variability because it was deposited there from wastewater, sprayed pesticides. The lead site was mixed incinerator ash with fill material, and the PCB site was just waste electrical oil. And we just posted part one of the study, which is basically a data dump, on our webpage in October, and we're working on part two, which goes more into implications. So here's the PCB site that we did. We always had a lot of trouble with PCBs with discrete samples, and now we know why. This is a 6,000 square foot site. We set up 24 grid points. We already knew from MIS, multi-increment sampling, and discrete sampling there are PCB problems here. At each grid point, we collected five essentially co-located discrete samples within 50, 100 centimeters of each other. We had those processed and tested for PCBs. And then we collected a sixth sample, which we split up into 10 subsamples and had the lab test each subsample. So the five co-located samples we're looking at, what we call intra-sample variability. And here's an example just from one of the grid points, the five co-located samples. You can see the PCB concentrations reported here varied by over an order of magnitude, just within a meter of each other. And this is all random. In the bottom right-hand corner where you see 6,100 milligrams per kilogram, that doesn't mean it's getting more contaminated in that area. If you stepped out another foot, then it might drop back down to 100 or 10 or something. These are all totally random concentrations around the grid point. Here's what we saw within the subsamples for the PCB site. So this is one discrete sample tested essentially 10 times, 10 random spoon aliquots of soil tested. And again, within one single sample, we see up to two orders of magnitude variability for PCBs within the sample. So this has a lot of implications for discrete sample work. In general, this is what we saw on average at the arsenic, lead, and PCB site. So within a grid point, say within 50 centimeters of a grid point at the arsenic site, we'd see on average twofold variability in arsenic concentrations for discrete samples. Not bad, actually. For lead sites, we'd see up on average 8 times, but up to 40 times variability in reported lead concentrations for discrete samples. PCB side, around a single grid point, on average, we'd see two orders of magnitude variability in PCB concentrations. So if I collected a discrete sample at a grid point and then got one concentration and moved over 1 or 2 feet, I could see two orders of magnitude above or below that first concentration. This has a lot of implications, if you think about it. This has implications for estimating the extent of contamination, reliability of confirmation samples. You know, what are these isolated hot spots and cold spots we often see? What's for usefulness of isolated concentration maps, adequacy of laboratory homogenization, which you can never really do. So lab prep, which I think Ed's going to talk about that. Estimation in situ contaminant mass, and even estimates of 95th percentile UCL and mean concentrations. Now, if you want to see what PCB and I bet a lot of munitions contamination looks like, get on Google Images and Google Jackson Pollock. That's the painting here below. And so you see a lot of small-scale variability in his paintings. If you collected discrete samples on top of his paintings, you could really fool yourself as far as the extent of contamination across the site. So really what you have to do is step back, look at the big picture. And that's what multi-increment sampling, as we call it, or incremental sampling, as the ITRC calls it, does in decision units. So for decision units, you hear me say DU a lot. And we use multi-increment sampling again, MIS, ITRC uses ISM. So it's specifically designed to address this small-scale variability or heterogeneity of contaminants in soil. It's been used in mining and agriculture industries for decades. And these are two industries where you can't afford to be wrong. And you know when you're wrong immediately with your data because you, all of a sudden you don't have any gold in your mine or all your crops die. So they have to be very careful with their sampling. And I work as a risk assessor and a geologist. A lot of things, one thing I realized several years ago is that, you know, a mining company would never risk their mine, or a farmer would never risk his crops on the type of discrete sampling that we did for decades. We started using a DU MIS approach in 2004. Again, Army Corps has been working on it before that. Published our first guidance in 2008. We're updating it next year. And it is similar to ITRC's document. Several of us, including me, were on their team. To date, I think we collected 15,000 or so MIS samples in Hawaii, and it's used at close to 100% of the sites in subsurface also, and VOCs and non-VOCs. We still use discrete data. It's still useful for screening sites. So first thing you have to understand is what a decision unit is. This is where you set the scale of your decision-making up front at a site. And the good news is you've already been doing it if you have not familiar with incremental sampling. But MIS gives you a better way to get better detail. An easy definition of a decision unit is the area and volume of soil that you would send to a lab as a single sample if you could dig it up and do that, which, of course, isn't practical. So you have to subsample it or collect the sample and send to the lab. The objective is to estimate a mean contaminant concentration in each designated DU. Now, our guidance, we split it up into two different types of DUs, spill areas, ITRC calls them source areas, and exposure areas. Now, spill areas, what you've always looked for out in the field, could be the blast crater around a exploded bomb or something. In this example, it might be an oil pit or the side of a transformer pad where you're looking for PCB contamination. So your decision, you would draw a line, basically draw a circle or a box around the area you suspect could be contaminated, and that's where you want to test, and you want to estimate the mean contaminant concentration within that decision unit. You also have exposure area decision units in the top picture. This is, say, a commercial site, the entire open yard there might be an exposure area from a risk standpoint where people are being exposed to soil on a regular basis for years. Or it could be your backyard or a part of your yard in the bottom right-hand picture. So you have spill, source areas, and exposure areas. These are your decision units. And the objective, again, is to collect a sample from these decision units, estimate the mean concentration of the contaminant, and you compare that to your screening levels. This is how, going back to the original site we were looking at, this is what we would do there, is first you divide the site up into decision units based on some agreed upon maximum exposure area. So you want to set a maximum size to your decision units or based on where you think there might be spill areas. This is typically a few hundred square feet to a few thousand square feet. So in this example, I just split it up into four decision units. Once you've set out your primary decision units and what you think is a contaminated area, you would put what we call perimeter DUs around that where you hope to establish a clean boundary. These perimeters you do use in the this picture are actually a lot smaller than we would use. Let's put them there in the example. So that there your decision is the next step in is to estimate the mean concentration of your target contaminant in each decision unit. The way you do that, in the past you might have collected two or three discrete samples within each one of those areas. Well, now we know that just doesn't work. So you can do really intensive sampling here in the bottom right-hand decision unit. You see all the X's. So based on sampling theory, which again the mining companies and other companies have been using for decades, you need to collect a very large sample from that area, at least 1 or 2 kilograms, just to get a representative soil sample. You're going to collect that from 30. We bump it up to 100 locations now, depending on what contaminant you're dealing with and how heterogeneous you expect it to be. It's easiest to sample this if you set up a systematic random grid. Each one of the X's there, you're going to collect 10 to 50 grams of soil, which we call an increment. And then you combine all the increments together and form one bulk sample, as you see on the bottom pictures there. And when the laboratory gets this, they take this bulk incremental sample. If it's non-volatile, they air dry it, sieve it less than 2 millimeters, and then they subsample it, similar to what you did in the field, and that's what they analyzed to preserve the quality of your field data. You can test the precision of this approach by collecting replicate samples. So you go back, shift your grid over halfway in between points or whatever, and collect another completely independent set of samples, and then do it again. So you collect three really big samples from the site. And if your replicate data line up pretty well, like in the example here, 140, 179, 135 ppm, that's pretty good reproducibility, so you know your precision is good. If the relative standard deviation is 35%, we call it a really good sample. And if needed, you can calculate 95th percentile UCLs on this also. So that's how you collect these samples. It's a lot of work in the field. And our office actually does a lot of our own field work. So when you go out in the field, you need to take a lot of different types of tools with you. Ideally, you check your site before you go. You have to collect core-shaped increments. You don't want wedge-shaped increments. So you don't bias your sample to the top or bottom of whatever targeted depth you're testing. If it's soft soil, you can use a simple sampling tube. If you happen to have nice, silty, compact volcanic soils like we have here, we actually use a battery-powered drill to collect our samples. First grade in silts, it really sucks in sand. Hard soils, there's all these other type of tools, slide hammers, picks. Now, those get to be a real hassle. We go out with a generator and electric hammer now. You see in the middle photo there to collect samples and gravel and such. You use backhoes, subsurface. You can use push rigs, trenches. We'll look at that again. So back to our example, here's what we would have done with this instead of discrete samples. We've already set our decision units. We can characterize the decision units using discretes or MIS. We would definitely use incremental samples. And here's just an example that now the red DUs we know are hot. They exceed our screening level, so something has to be done there. In the bottom right-hand corner, one of our perimeter DUs came up above the screening level, so we have to go back and do additional testing, but that's usually very limited. So now we can make decisions on this. It's going to take you longer in the field. You can think more about how to set up DUs. We collect, I think, hundreds of increments from this area instead of just a few discrete samples. But in the end, this is much more cost efficient. I'm going to end up actually going over some just examples of decision units, because once you get out in the field and start doing this, it's actually real obvious that incremental sampling, I think, you're much better off. You get much better data for some targeted area, making a decision, this area is clean, this area is contaminated. What it really comes down to is kind of an art of setting decision units, designating decisions in the field. And again, the good news is you've already been doing this. It actually makes work a lot more fun once you get this process down. So here's a former power plant here. We knew in the back left-hand corner they were repairing transformers that was contaminated with PCBs. So the next slide is how we would set up a decision units for this area. When you have known source areas, known spill areas, you want to keep your decision units pretty small, a few hundred to a few thousand square feet, especially for remediation, just so you get good resolution on which soil is contaminated, which soil isn't. That's the red DUs. The yellow DUs weren't expecting much contamination, so you can set those larger. The maximum size would be your maximum acceptable exposure area. You're setting a larger DU is less field work, but then if you happen to mess up in that area, part of that DU is contaminated, then you have to declare the entire soil within that DU contaminated. So you have to think about that a lot. It's a trade-off. you see the green perimeter DUs we put around the contaminated area just to verify a clean boundary. Here's another example is an old pesticide mixing area we knew was contaminated with arsenic and dioxin, especially around these buildings. We knew there was tanks and spill areas there. The outer area we also knew was contaminated, but there's no known localized spill areas. Here's how we split this area up hypothetically. That is similar to what we actually did. The red, again, are fairly small spill area, source area disease units. In each one of these DUs, we're going to collect one multi-increment sample. We'll collect replicates in a certain percentage of them. And then the yellow, again, is maximum DU size. These are hypothetical lots. They're actually putting a residential site on top of this area. And then the green perimeter DUs around the exterior, again, just to verify that we caught the contamination. So again, the maximum DU size is your exposure area. Here's a close-up of that site. Here's the tanks. We knew there was heavy contamination under the tank, but we don't collect two or three discrete samples. We're going to collect 50 increments after we delineate the disease unit, combine that into one sample and have the lab test it. And then in the outer areas, we're worried about arsenic and dioxins. Again, those are the exposure area DUs. We still use discrete data. This is a site that was fairly recently done. We knew this heavy arsenic contamination was 9 acres. We're having trouble with our DUs, trying to figure out exactly where the contamination was. So the consultant went out with the portable XRF, did very detailed discrete sampling, and used it to fairly accurately identify the heaviest area of contamination in the top of this figure. And the bottom area was pretty obviously clean. The danger zone is this middle area here where the variability, small-scale variability, crosses above and below your screening level. So what happens is you'll start seeing lots of isolated hot spots and cold spots. This just means that area is highly variable. Digging out those individual hot spots and cold spots is pretty useless or pointless. If you shifted all this grid over, that middle area, shifted the grid over halfway or a few feet, you'd see similar patterns, but your hot spots and cold spots would be in different areas. So that's the danger zone. That's really where you get messed up with your confirmation samples, is when your variability goes above and below your screening levels. So at this site, we might split it up into DUs again. The red, we keep them fairly small because we suspect contamination in that area. And again, in the lower part of the diagram, the DUs are fairly large. We don't expect contamination based on our discrete data. We're going to go back in again and collect incremental samples in each one of these DUs. Usually we collect replicate samples in at least 10% of the disease units, as long as they are in similar history. As you can have really big disease units. Here's one. It's the former ag field they're going to put housing on. Just for a quick screen, we usually split the large areas up into 15 DUs. A similar thing, you collect multi-increment sample in each one of these replicates and some. Split out your heavily contaminated areas separately. You can get a better resolution by testing some select number of, in this case, like five random hypothetical 5,000 square foot lots within that area. You get a better resolution of your contaminant concentrations in smaller DUs. You do the same thing for bombing ranges. They did one here, I think, was they split the bombing range up 100,000 acres into very large DUs for initial screening and then looked at, focused in on the explosive areas, craters, for a better resolution. You can do this also for Chesapeake Range. You can include ecological concerns. Former flat shooting platforms here, and the green outlines the area where the pellets were falling and the clay pigeons. So you might split this up into DUs again. The red are kind of your source area decision. Just keep them fairly small. You know where that was. And then the outer areas you want to test, you talk to your ecological risk assessors, and based on birds or shoreline flora and fauna, you split those areas up into ecological-based DUs. Again, you collect an MI sample in each one of these. Look at the mean concentration for use in risk assessment. You can do this for excavations also. You could, even before or after you excavate, a lot of times you do it before, just you drill down to the bottom of the, where you, until you find what you think is a clean layer, collect an MI sample across it, and also test your walls using by designating decision is collecting incremental samples. And confirm the concentrations of your contaminants in your in your outer DUs around the area you can excavate. Do the same thing for stockpiles, split it up into decision volumes based on how the soil is going to be used. If not for residential use, you're going to split it up into 1 to 400 cubic yard thoughts and then test each one using MI samples. I can do the same thing for subsurface, digging trenches. Here they're testing the sidewall of a trench, looking at layers, exposed area, layers of exposed parts of decision and layers using incremental sampling. So you collect an increment of each one of the bars there and combine it into one sample. Do that for each layer. And you can also drill. You know, subsurface decision is just have soil on top of them. You have to drill through to collect your increments. But again, you drill down to your target layer. Each core through that layer is an increment, and you combine all your increments together to form a bulk sample. Usually that's going to be way too large, so you have to subsample your increments to form your bulk sample. That's shown in the next slide here. This is going to be fairly common. Push rigs, easy soil, you can get 300 feet a day. So you can sometimes say do 3 decision units a day with a push rig. The biggest trouble with push rigs is having enough people to subsample and manage the soil. The rig doesn't really slow people down. And also do what we call single boring DUs. It comes up a lot at a gas station. I can't put in 30 borings to look for contamination. You really need to, depends on what your decision is. It's pretty common set at gas tanks with leaking tanks. You can make a decision based on one boring on the presence or absence of contamination at that point. So you can do that, but instead of collecting a discrete sample at targeted at specified depths, you're going to split your core up into targeted layers, so you clean or contaminate suspected layers, and you subsample those and test them. And the same thing with VOCs. In your increments, you put in a methanol in the field instead of, or you can freeze them and send them to the lab, and the lab will combine them into samples. Do the same thing for sediment. A lot of the sediment DUs are going to be eco-based. I know Ed's worked on some of those. There's lots of different ways to collect your sediment samples. So the bottom line here is you get what you pay for. You get really good data, make very firm decisions based on incremental samples. It's going to cost a little bit more in the upfront time spending and collecting the samples, but you get decreased laboratory costs and end up with a much more defensible decisions and much more expedited cleanup and closure. So in the long run, it saves you time. That's it, and Steve's going to talk real quickly about MIS at Munison sites in Hawaii. I'll pass it over to him.
Thanks, Roger. Yeah, this is Steve. Yeah, pretty much what I'm going to talk about a little bit is how we've been using MIS out at these munition sites that we have around Hawaii, because most of our munition sites are FUD sites. They're formerly used defense sites that we have, about maybe 40 to 50 some odd of these throughout the Hawaiian Islands. And what we like most about the MIS is that it allows us to really go after these areas that we know are going to be contaminated or may be contaminated, with, whether it be a bombing target, a berm, target fans, impact areas, maneuver areas. It allows us really to focus in on these areas. That's what makes MIS so good to use at these areas, because we can just say, okay, that's the area you want to make your DU around. Second of all, it becomes a numbers game when you look at it versus discrete samples. In discrete samples, let's take a berm, for example. If you could just arbitrarily take 30-some-odd discrete samples, or you could take one DU and do a triplicate as an MIS sample. Just by numbers alone, you're looking at 3 samples versus 30. You could even go so far as to cut that berm up into 3 different DUs, and you don't still only come up with 9 samples versus the 30 you would have had to have done had you done discrete samples. So in terms of cost effectiveness, MI sampling is much more advantageous, especially as the areas get bigger. Like over small areas, you could probably make an argument. But for very vast areas, like many of these munition sites are, MIS is the preferred method of choice. And finally, what we do in terms of MIS, it's very easy to do. A lot of the areas we deal with in Hawaii, a lot of the old bombing areas and things, are undeveloped areas, fortunately. So a lot of times we can just traverse the area very quickly, take these increments over large areas, and be able to gather our data very quickly, especially since most of the munitions constituents problems are surface. I mean, there are situations where it could potentially get to groundwater if you had that much RDX or so, as Jay mentioned earlier. But for the most part, when we're talking about areas that have been actively used for active fire type thing, what we're going to see more is surface-related activities or craters. You'd see the crater. But even that technically is surface now, because now you just have a big hole in the ground. So what did we learn from all of this? wonderful MC sampling. What we're really learning is that for the majority of our sites, MC is not driving these sites. It's predominantly the explosive physical hazards that we're encountering when dealing with these items. A good example just happened yesterday with what we found was a 75-millimeter white phosphorus round that had to be dealt with. And as Jay mentioned earlier, white phosphorus in of itself is a chemical. It's not going to be hanging around a long time. But what it does present is more of a physical hazard in terms of burning. So if you're in a very dry area with a lot of dead or dry vegetation, it becomes a significant concern in an MMRP area where there's a lot of munitions being found. Because once you start a brush fire in that type of area, you have a multitude of issues in terms of just fire in of itself, but other munitions that may be there as well. So a lot of the times, the driver for what we're doing at these sites, it's mainly not being driven by the MC sampling or by even the results we're getting. Because a lot of the results we're getting for the MC sampling is relatively minuscule. Because what we did to try to test this theory out as well was to do what we call pre- and post-BIP sampling. A lot of the times we're going to have to BIP these items, so what we do is we test as safely as we can. We try to take a samples around these items before we blow it up, and then we come back after and we test the area to see post-BIP whether or not any residual chemicals remain. And as of this date, I don't believe there was any situation with our pre- and post-BIP sampling that indicated an issue with MC. And finally, the MIS sampling with MC, where it does actually work very well for us, is with small arms. And I think the previous speakers alluded to this earlier in some shape or form, with pistol, rifle, and skeet ranges, where it's very effective. You know where your targeting fans are. You know where your berms are. You can easily target those as decision units, map them out, take your samples, and be able to really get to the heart of what areas need to be addressed versus those that aren't as bad. Moving right along to our last slide, conclusions from our MC sampling efforts. And this is sort of even beyond just MIS sampling, but just MC sampling in general. What we're finding is that a lot of the items that we've been finding in the, like our biggest area, the Waikoloa Maneuver area, about 120,000 acres worth of land, is that the chemical contamination is virtually non-existent. We're not finding it in our sampling. And whether or not we're sampling enough, well, you can argue that potentially, or whether or not it's your DUs are too big, potentially you could make that kind of an argument. But what we found is that with the very large items, even with these large craters, even with these items that we have to take and BIP them, even if before we blow it up, after we blow it up, we're not finding the energetics, we're not finding the metals at all. Another point that we take home from MC sampling efforts overall is that we're finding lead. I found it interesting earlier that they mentioned tungsten. Usually we haven't been seeing too much tungsten in our analyte suites, but mainly the lead. We're not even seeing that much antimony, really. We're seeing mainly lead, and that's because of the lead shot and the bullet casings and things like that sort, where at our small arms ranges, lead is the driver more often than not. And we also did a study, this is to bullet number three, is that the site we call Ordnance Reef, where we have a lot of illicit dumping out at the Hawaiian Islands, where essentially you take the boat out maybe 100, 200 feet, and you just push it off your boat, because at the time that was an acceptable way of disposing of munitions, was to just dump it in the water. So what happened is that there was a study done by the Army to check out whether or not these munitions were decomposing and causing a threat to the ecological environments in the water. And this was actually in conjunction with oversight by EPA Region 9. Judy Hong is the person in charge of that one. And what we determined through our analyses and sampling was that pretty much you're not seeing appreciable amounts of contamination from these munitions into the ocean water. And finally, I guess just to wrap up what we've been saying the whole time is with MC sampling is its most beneficial use or application is at small arm ranges and depots. because that's where you're really going to have sites where the chemical hazard is going to trump the explosives hazard. And that's really where we should try to keep our MC sampling efforts focused on, because a lot of times we, in terms of where we want to always look at, whether it be fade and transport, whether it be delineation of a site through remedial investigations and feasibility studies, we always want to be able to target what we believe is the biggest hazard. And what we're finding is that for the most part, the MC is not really, you can't really find a direct link between the bigger items, like the 155 shells, the 105 shells, the very big explosive types of munitions, and the MC sampling. There doesn't seem to be a real close correlation between having high MC contamination and a high MEC hazard. And so that's our presentation.
Very good. Steve, Roger, very much appreciate it. Good information on incremental sampling. I tell you what, we're going to have a little bit of an abbreviated intermission. I still want to start our startup with the next speaker at 10 till, so please, everybody, get up, stretch, take a quick restroom break, get some caffeine, and we will start up in just a few minutes. Thank you.
And just a reminder, while we're on that break, we're going to bring up some of those interactive poll questions that we had loaded in the room earlier. So if you didn't have a chance to vote on some of our questions, you'll see them appear on the screen now. Remember to cast your vote. Simply click on the circle to the answer on the left side that, of the answer that best corresponds with your individual response. Just want to check to see if Dwayne Ford has come back on the line. Dwayne, are you there?
Yes, Jane. Sorry, I had the phone on mute. My apologies. Yeah, and so yes, by all means, let's go ahead and get started with next speakers. And our next speaker is Ed Coral, and Ed's the deputy director up at the NAFC Lab Quality and Accreditation Office, and he's got over a couple of decades of experience with environmental chemistry. And he's also working on his doctorate in environmental engineering. So, Ed, glad to have you speak and talk to us about H330B.
Okay, thanks, Dwayne. I feel a lot older now after that introduction, but I appreciate that. So, again, I wanted to also, before I begin, thanks to Gene and the agency for hosting this, and also to Dwayne and Deb for the kind invitation. Obviously, these type of issues work across the entire environmental community, so it's a good chance to work collaboratively with both the agency and with the Army. So the Environmental Data Quality Work Group, and I'll give a little bit more background information on our organization in just a moment. But we've received many questions at a conference, as we do every year in Omaha this past year, and also online regarding Method 8330B and its implementation into our program. So this training is to help clarify some of the quality system requirements. And again, I'll give you a little bit of background material on that in just a moment. But just as a point of clarification, this presentation is actually a canned down version of somewhat of a two-hour filibuster I gave on 8330B last week. But this training is not a critique of EPA 8330B. As Roger had alluded to, you know, Roger and Jay and I actually participated on the original ITRC work group for multi-increment sampling. So without a doubt, multi-increment sampling itself provides superior coverage. And if your end objective is to obtain a representative average concentration over a specific decision unit, without question, multi-increment sampling is a superior method. But this presentation and the training that I gave last week really has to do with the incorporation of the requirements of our program for the accreditation program in the So just to give you a little bit of background on that, so the Environmental Data Quality Work Group consists of course, principal components from all the different DOD components. And it's chaired by my boss, who's Jordan Adelson out of NAVC. In our program, we manage the Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Program, also known as ELAP, and basically all the laboratories, the commercial laboratories that are performing environmental work, and in our case for this particular training, 8330B, for any of the DOD or DOE services have to be accredited into our program. And that's based upon the requirements are actually documented in our quality systems manual, and the current version of that quality systems manual is version 5, and the requirements are also in line with ISO 17025 TNI, and we also have some additional DOD requirements, and some of the additional DOD requirements I'll be laying out today. So again, the purpose of the presentation really is just to clarify the QSM requirements relative to the labs that are implementing 8330B into our program. The main QC criteria for 8330B can be found in Table 3 of the Quality System Manual. And there's also, in the back, there are some LCS data or LCS limits in Appendix C of that as well. So just a little bit of a background regarding 8330B. I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but the original 8330 was published in 94. There was a revision 1, 8330A, that was ironically published after 8330B. I can't speak for the agency on that. I can only assume it was probably some logistical things going on in the agency. But so 8330B, which I'm explaining today, was revision 2 and came out October of 2006. And it was very special in terms of the EPA methods because Appendix A has a summary of collecting and processing of representative samples or multi-increment sampling, as Roger had just described. So in response to that, the EDQW has come out with some documents relative to the incorporation of the multi-increment sampling part of 830B into our requirements. So the QSM version 5 came out in 2013. We produced some 8330B training. I gave some 8330B training at our conference in April this past year. We've produced some frequently asked questions, which we published on the DNICS website, and I'll give you some of those URLs in just a moment, just a few weeks ago, as a matter of fact. Last week, I provided a two-hour web-based training, and again, what you're going to be hearing today is kind of a canned-down version of that. So there are some analytical differences between the previous version and 8330B. 8330B introduced some additional analytes, NG nitroglycerin, the tetranitrate, which is, as Jay had said, is really, I think, in detcord, and also the 3,5-dinitroaniline. And as I previously mentioned, Appendix A provides the guidance for incremental sampling. So as part of the differences that we've seen between 8330A and 8330B, there's differences in the subsample particle size and the weight, the extractions and the final volumes of those extractions. There was the addition of a shaker platform, and there was an elimination of one of the additional cleanup steps, the calcium chloride cleanup step, that was eliminated from the previous version. So 8330B calls for the processing of the entire field sample. So in the previous version, a lab would be accustomed to getting a jar of soil, as Roger has already given you some good empirical information, the fact that, typically our ability to really capture a representative sample of the site by just taking a small portion of a top of a jar is really full of pitfalls. So 8330B with the multi-increment sampling, whereas a lab was typically accustomed to receiving a jar, now the laboratory is receiving 1 to 2 kilograms of sample, and there's also some additional sample preparation that comes with that. So these introduced, along with a couple of analytical requirements that the EDQW has put out, makes for some implementation challenges specifically for this method. So the sample needs to be dried. The entire sample needs to be dried at room temperature. And according to our requirements, the EDQW requirements in the QSM, the room temperature and the temperature of the room has to be monitored. Drying and sieving should be performed in controlled conditions. That is not a QSM requirement, but that is something that we strongly recommend. I think most folks are doing the sieving in the laboratories now. It has been done in the field, but there is a chance for cross-contamination, so we recommend that the sieving be done in a controlled environment such as a laboratory, or you can get cross-contamination. So of all the salient issues that are associated with the EDQW's program requirements for 8330B, one of the most salient is the drying issue, especially relative to the laboratory control sample. So as I mentioned from the previous slide, all samples have to be dried, including the method blank. The laboratory control sample is not required to be dried. Now, that is actually a change from the typical requirements of EDQW and the Quality Systems Manual. Typically, all LCS samples, all laboratory control samples, must be treated identically to all the field samples. The reason that we're making a change with this in 8330B is, and more specifically, we are disallowing or recommending that the LCS not be dried. And the main reason for that is there are some constituents that are part of 8330B that are sufficiently volatile where they are very quickly and very quantitatively lost. And, you know, Jay gave an excellent presentation, actually an excellent segue into this presentation, and I don't want to speak for Jay, but you did notice, at least I noticed, that when he showed some of the data of what explosive compounds that are found in a lot of the ranges, there was no mention of nitrobenzene or the single nitro toluene isomers, and that's because they are volatile and they're very quickly lost at ranges. So as you can well imagine, drying the sample in the laboratory, you're going to very, very quickly lose those constituents. So the whole purpose of a control sample is so that a laboratory can monitor the performance of the entire method. And as they're monitoring the performance of the method, if they're seeing a problem or they're seeing a trend, they can tweak their processes, whether it's in the extraction process or whether it's in the analytical process, to bring that problem back under control. Obviously, because of the volatility of these four particular compounds, that's out of the laboratory's control. There's nothing they can do to tweak their process aside from eliminating the drying step. So for all intents and purposes, we are calling this a drying LCS, or grinding LCS, if you will, because we are omitting the drying step. Now, the matrix of the LCS can be a vendor-supplied reference material, and I'll give you some examples of that in just a moment, or it can be a spiked matrix blank using some clean matrices such as Ottawa sand. So just to exemplify some of the known issues that we have with the volatilization of some of these compounds, Dr. Tom Georgian presented some data that I believe were some data he actually got from the Coal Regions Laboratory. And that data showed some empirical evidence of both drying and grinding studies relative to some 8330B compounds. So just real quick, some of the bullets of the summary results, and I'll show you a graph of the empirical data here in just a moment. After 5 days of drying at room temperature, the nitrobenzene and the nitrotoluene isomers are very quickly lost, resulting in zero recoveries. And the 11 remaining explosives are also, by the way, negatively biased, but those constituents can be recovered efficiently, especially relative to our program requirements, if the grinding steps and the extraction steps are very closely followed relative to the method. Concentrations of the unground LCS has decreased about 2% on average after about 30 minutes of drying, increasing the grinding time from 90 to 240 seconds, decreased the recoveries of the 15 compounds by an average of about 4 to 5%. The reference material that's used as the LCS should not be air dried. It should be processed very quickly. It should be ground and processed very quickly. Excessive grinding of the laboratory control sample should be avoided, as this can negatively bias all the compounds. So just a quick screenshot of the data that Tom showed. And as you can see from this, again, the nitrobenzene and the nitrotoluene isomers are very quickly and very quantitatively lost after 5 days. Even after the first day, the recoveries are quite noticeable, while the other compounds are fairly steady. Now, you will note there was a question for me last week when I gave this presentation. You'll notice that tetryl is missing from this. A lot of the standard reference materials or the reference materials that are available to laboratories, they may not contain all the explosive compounds. So if the laboratory is accredited and the particular project requires a constituent that is not in here, then they would have to spike that reference material prior to grinding and processing the sample. So sieving is required also. Each sample, and that's including the laboratory control sample and the method blank, has to be sieved. The entire sample, and again, we're talking about 1 to 2 kilograms of sample, has to be weighed. Of course, that the drying does not apply to the LCS again. Sieve the entire sample with a 2 millimeter standard sieve. The pieces should be broken up with the gloved hand. There are some wonderful instructions in Appendix A of the method for directions on this. You should not intentionally include vegetation. What I mean here is really large sticks and rocks.
unless the project specifies. And the portion that does not pass through the sieve, according to the quality system manual requirements, that portion has to be collected and it has to be weighed as well. Again, there are standard reference materials available. Again, the material must be ground prior to the extraction and analysis. Again, it's not dried. And they may not contain all the project analytes, and any of the analytes that are not present in the reference material will have to be spiked prior to the grinding process. So there are different grinders that are available. In the early days of 8330, and we were doing some prep, you know, there was the old mortar and pestle, and actually the mortar and pestle can still be used, although those are extremely labor-intensive. Any mode of grinding that reduces the particle size to less than 75 microns, and that's consistently over all the type of samples that are received by the laboratory, those can be used. The EDQW does not require or mandate a specific grinder, although we highly prefer and recommend the puck mill because of its flexibility. It's very superior in being able to grind the samples to a common sample size. And it also allows, or we have allowed within our program, that if a laboratory is using a puck mill, they are allowed to subsample the reference material. So the either the subsample, the reference sample can be aliquoted and subsampled and ground that way, or the entire control sample can be ground, and then subsamples of the ground reference material can then be used for batch control as the LCS batch control. And again, it's highly recommended that the ground LCSs, if you're using the puck mill, be stored in an amber bottle and refrigerated. If a laboratory in our program is not using a puck mill, then there has to be batch-to-batch grinding for laboratory control samples. So only the subsampling is only allowed if the laboratory is using the puck mill. What about grinding blanks? When 8330B first came out, the EDQW was very concerned about the possibility of carryover. So initially, in the early days, we were thinking about requiring a blank between grinding, and we've backed off of that requirement. So the current requirement is that the grinding blanks are prepared. First of all, they have to be prepared and analyzed in exactly the same way as the samples, of course. They can be prepared and analyzed individually or as a composite. The requirements of the grinding blank is that no analytes can be detected at greater than one half of the LOQ. So all samples and QC samples must be subsampled in the same manner. And I think Roger was alluding to this a little bit earlier. So what has been quite a bit confusing to a lot of folks who are incorporating multi-increment sampling. Roger showed quite a few slides of how multi-increment sampling is done in the field. So that's the field MIS. And there's also the replicates that are done in the field. So those are the field replicates. Well, after the sample is prepped in the laboratory, so it's dried and it's ground and it's sieved and prepped in the laboratory, then the prepped sample, the entire sample, is laid out and incremental sampling is again performed in the laboratory. So we call this basically a laboratory MIS sample, if you will. And all these procedures are done to make sure that we are getting a representative sample of what was in the original decision unit. So the laboratory, again, this is part of our requirements of our program, and actually this is right out of the method as well. The entire ground sample is mixed, it's spread out, and then 30 or more randomly located increments are taken. So that the final subsample taken represents about 10 grams. So this applies to the QC samples, and then the matrix spikes and MSDs are also taken after the subsampling. Okay, so there are a few requirements that don't have anything to do with Appendix A and the multi-increment sampling process. And more specifically, these are sort of lessons learned and requirements. So these are the additional DoD requirements that I alluded to earlier that we have for laboratories implementing 8330B in our program. Solid phase extraction for aqueous samples are only allowed within the ELAP accreditation program. There's an additional procedure called salting out that's mentioned in 8330B for aqueous samples that we disallow. The salting out procedure can be very, very tricky, and it's not very repeatable. So it is a program requirement that only solid phase extraction is required by laboratories that are accredited under ELAP. The solid phase extraction media should be resin-based. In other words, the silica-based solid phases really do have a limited retention capacity for some of the compounds, primarily RDX and HMX, and therefore they are not allowed within our program. And surrogates and the matrix spikes cannot be added to the solid phase extraction media. They have to be added to the sample and mixed before they undergo the solid phase extraction. So all these are requirements as part of the aqueous media. So 8330B still incorporates high-performance liquid chromatography. It does require a confirmation analysis by UV detection using a column with a different retention time order. We had quite a few questions regarding diode array detectors for 8330B, which the PDA is mentioned in 8330B. For our program, the PDA is not permitted for confirmation analysis. There are some clarifications regarding the use of PDA as a primary detector that stem from a lot of questions we got from the training we gave last week, and those answers are going to be forthcoming. As the EDQW is a consensus organization, so some of these more very tricky questions we have to run by the principals before final decision making. So we will be getting out to the environmental community and answering some of these more trickier questions by providing those on the DNX website very, very soon. The use of a mass spectrometer, either an LCMS or either in a tandem mode, is actually allowed in 8330B. We highly recommend the use of mass spec due to its specificity. And if a laboratory is using LCMS or LCMS-MS, a confirmation analysis is not required. Again, the criteria for the laboratory control samples, one is required per preparation batch. There is an appendix C, in the back of the quality system manual. That provides for tables for batch control if project limits are not specified. So in other words, our program requirements stipulate that if the particular project does not specify its own limits for meeting LCS criteria, then the LCS criteria that's found in Appendix C of the Quality System Manual has to be met. And the tables 33 and 34 are the LCS limits by the mass spec methods. And again, this is an Appendix C of the Quality System Manual. And then tables 36 and 37 are for the analysis for both soils and waters by the HPLC UV method. Dr. Chun-Ray Mao and Chuck Coyle from the Army gave a wonderful presentation at our conference this past year. There are some facilities that are currently using alkaline hydrolysis to treat some of the soils at some ranges, and the questions have been storming in about how the soils should be pre-treated prior to submission to the laboratory for 8330B, and Chun-Ray and Chuck gave some wonderful information about neutralizing those soils prior to submitting the samples. There are currently no quality system requirements in terms of the EDQW's accreditation program relative to soil treatment. So at this time, you know, we may update the next version of the QSM that hasn't been discussed yet, but for the time being, we think these are fairly rare, but if there are any sites out there that are using soil treatment, using alkaline hydrolysis, and you have some questions about pre-treating the soils, we highly recommend that you contact either Chuck or Chun Ray or somebody within the Army, and they can give you some guidance on that. So these are some of our resources. The frequently asked questions that we published last month are on this first URL. We're going to be including a recording of the training that I gave last week, and including a compendium of list of all the many, many questions that we got regarding that and some of the answers. And you can find those on the URL at the bottom. So with that, Duane, that concludes my presentation. And if we have some time, I'll be glad to take some questions.
Yeah, great. Good scoop there, Ed. And yes, actually, we do have a few minutes. We've had a couple of questions that have come in. And the first one is, when you're MIS sampling for explosive metals, is putt mill grinding, is that required for the metals analysis?
Well, so actually this presentation and our requirements has to do with accreditation of 8330B, which is really only for explosive compounds. So I don't want to put Jay on the spot, but I'm sure Jay's online. This is I'm going to defer this question to Jay because he's really the expert with metals.
Okay. Jay, you still out there, Jay?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
So where we're at, there's a working group within EPA working on an update to Method 3050B, and the recommendation will be for either use of a puck mill or what's called a ball mill or a roller mill. Equally work as well. In the situation where you're interested in both explosives and metals, then you're going to have to use the puck mill if you're going to just have one sample and not split it. If you're going to split the sample, then you could do puck mill in one and ball mill in the other.
Thanks, okay. Jay.
Good. Yeah, appreciate it, Jay. Another question that we had there, Ed, was how are laboratories, how are they accredited for the grinding for the 8330B?
There are, again, in Table 3 of the Quality Systems Manual, there are specific requirements in terms of the actual grinding itself. The laboratory has to, for instance, a requirement is that the laboratory has to demonstrate that the grinding procedure is capable of reducing the particle size to less than 75 microns. That's something that they have to show empirically. And then that's actually done by passing the sample through a 200 mesh sieve. And then the other quality requirements in terms of grinding blanks and those type of things are actually also included, as I had mentioned earlier, in the same table of the Quality Systems Manual.
Okay. Very good. I think time for just one more quick question that I see it popped up. Is there a concern for using the method regarding explosive crystals?
It's an excellent question, and I had addressed that last week, and because we were under an abbreviated timeline, I eliminated a few slides, so I apologize for that. Obviously, grinding of pure nuggets of explosive material can result in an acute exposure. So it's not something that we highly recommend. The Appendix A of Method 8330B is very clear about excluding, identifying and excluding particles of pure energetics. And I highly recommend that the participants look at Appendix A. It gives you very, very, very good directions on what to do in those particular instances.
Very good. Wonderful. All right. Like I said, very good scoop there, Ed. We appreciate it. Nice presentation. Okay. Well, we're getting ready to move into our next speakers. And we have some co-presenters for this next presentation. And we have Danil Jorgensen, who's with Emma Foster Wheeler. And Danielle is she's an environmental chemist and database specialist with about 10 years of experience in environmental chemistry. And then our co-presenter is going to be Chuck Neslin, and Chuck is with the Eurofins Lancaster Laboratories Environmental, and they're going to be talking to us about hydrazine, a compound that we don't frequently encounter at our munitions response site, but it is a possibility. And so talk to us some about hydrazine, Danielle.
All right. Well, thank you, Dwayne. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm really excited for this opportunity to present on analytical methods for hydrazine. As Dwayne mentioned, I'm co-presenting with Chuck Neslin, who's the technical director for Eurofins. I refer to him as the hydrazine expert. Today's presentation, we're going to cover a few topics. To start off with, our purpose is that we want to share with you what some of your options are for the analytical methods for hydrazine. So if you do need to analyze for it on your project, you can select a method that will provide data that meets your data quality objectives. So we're going to talk about the chemical structure of hydrazine, its uses, and where you might encounter it on a project. As Dwayne mentioned, and as you probably saw in the other presentations, it's fairly unique and rare due to its chemical properties and what it was used for. We're also going to talk about analytical methods, so we're going to cover what methods are out there, and Chuck's going to get down in the weeds with the pros and the cons about that. And then we're going to go into a case study, which is where Chuck and I first connected, was on this project. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Chuck.
All right, Danielle, thank you very much. And I want to thank everyone for attending this afternoon and hanging in there. I was going to ask the question, do we all need to, although we can't verify this, but do we all need to stand up and do a couple of jumping jacks here to make sure we stay awake through my, at least my part of the talk? Because you can see my first slide there, it was chemical structures, talking about hydrazines. In particular, Danielle's project, we were looking at hydrazine, but we've got a number of hydrazines that are of concern, potentially of concern, used for a number of different purposes. And when you look at those, as a chemist looking at those structures, hydrazine, methyl hydrazine, and 1,1-dimethyl hydrazine, see, we've got relatively small molecular weight compounds, things that exist as a liquid but are relatively volatile, and they also react pretty readily when exposed in the environment. But part of the reason, and the biggest reason why we've rolled them into this discussion, is the first bullet there, is that they're commonly known for use as rocket fuels and propellants, also used in the power supplies for fighter jets, but then more commonly also used as a precursor to the manufacture of blowing agents for polymer foams, also the gas, the material that's used for your airbags in cars and the like. So they are prevalent, they are around. The other issue to point out is that one of those compounds, the unsymmetrical dimethyl hydrazine, 1,1-dimethyl hydrazine, is a compound that has been linked to in the environment, when in the environment, that it can be converted to NDMA, which stands for N-dimethyl nitrosoamine, and which is a known carcinogen. So there is some good reason for keeping a close tab on the presence of that precursor in the environment. So if you do a literature review of the analytical approaches for hydrazines, there are some, but there aren't a lot. There aren't any EPA published methods for the analysis of hydrazine. The colorimetric one that is listed there, and I'll talk about here in a second, is actually an ASTM method, and you'll see some other academic applications where they've used liquid chromatography with either a refractive index detector or a UV, ultraviolet detector. And some applications where they use gas chromatography with derivatization. But the problems with most of these methods, these applications, are that they suffer from high limits, and the specificity of the analysis also suffers because of the type of detector that you're using for the analysis. In other words, it's not a very specific detector. So we're going to talk a little bit about the colorimetric method, which is the ASTM method. You see the reference there, 1385. It's colorimetric determination that is applicable to water samples, and strictly water samples. And in fact, when you read through the methodology, you really sense that it was primarily set up to look at hydrazine residues in boiler feed waters and condensates from where it's used as a bactericide. So then it's also, for environmental applications, have had some extension out to doing well waters. But in this application, we're really only calibrating and only looking for hydrazine and not specifically rolling in the methyl or the 1,1-dimethylhydrazine. Water samples get adjusted to a low pH with a hydrochloric acid. As is typical, what you would typically see in an EPA-derived method is we would have a specific holding time and a very specific pH or preservative type technique. This is the way this method is handled, is a little more loose. They're derivatized with, you can see, the paradimethyl aminobenzaldehyde to form a colored complex, which then you use a spectrophotometer operated at 458 nanometers. So the problem with that is, it's simple enough, but the problem with that kind of generic, all larger encompassing detection technique, the spectrophotometer, is that it can be prone to false positives. So you can see here, we give some other details with the calibration curve up to a concentration of 200 parts per billion, a low point on your curve of 5 parts per billion. It doesn't really have provisions for LCS. Does list some criteria for precision and recovery from a multi-laboratory study, but no specific criteria for how blanks are treated, LCSs, matrix spike, whether any kind of specific measure within your analytical procedure and protocol for determination of accuracy and precision. Like I indicate there, in the last bullet, is interferences can include a number of different oxidizing substances. Colored water is going to give you a bias right from the get-go, and then any turbidity in your water will give you potentially false positives for this analysis. So, for Eurofins Lancaster Laboratories, we were approached a number of years ago by a client about looking at, because they suspected or had a situation where we needed to delve into the possibility of contamination or the presence of hydrazine and the methylhydrazine and 1,1-dimethylhydrazine at a particular site, but wanted to try and get away from the colorimetric method because they knew it was not always completely reliable depending on the nature of the samples and the sample matrix. So came to us, asked us to take a look at developing a method that might do a more specific, more sensitive, better job. So we right away went to looking at applying LCM-SMS. Better sensitivity, much better specificity, because we could reduce the probability of interferences. We also, as we looked through it, had the possibility of using only a very small volume, which then made it a green method. We could get away from using a lot of solvents in an extraction and processing. and that also the fact that we're using a good chromatographic separation technique was going to allow us to do the several different hydrazines that would be that could possibly be present. So have some proprietary techniques that we incorporated that affected our ability to, that improved our ability to derivatize and detect the compound. But in general, we're using the chemistry that's similar to an EPA method, 8315, for the analysis of formaldehyde. It's just that we're doing it in the reverse, which is instead of using in the case of the formaldehyde analysis, you're using an aldehyde and you're derivatizing it with a type of hydrazine type material and forming a complex that you can then detect. We're doing just the opposite. We've got hydrazine and we're using an aldehyde complex, like in the ASTM method, to form a compound that we can easily detect by LC-MS/MS. And again, small volume required for analysis, only a mil for water and a gram for soils. So the LC-MS/MS with using atmospheric pressure chemical ionization, APCI, and you can see we've got some limits that we're able to achieve here. And again, to remind you that we're not extracting large volumes of the sample, but on a direct injection of a derivatized water extract, we're able to see a tenth of a part per billion, and that's an LOQ. So an MDL would be lower than that, a tenth of a part per billion for hydrazine, and in soil, 2 parts per billion of hydrazine. And give you an example chromatogram to show you the specificity, the good chromatographic separation. Up here at the top is what's called the total ion chromatogram. So that shows all three peaks that we're separating. And then here we've got the extracted ion or selected reaction mass for each of the different hydrazines. And you see very low background, so good signal to noise ratio and good sensitivity. So in summary, in this method, we're able to, because we modeled it after EPA type methodology, and adopting that and incorporated the LC-MS/MS, we're able to and have set it up to be able to run full EPA QC with each analytical batch, method blank, LCS, LCSD, and then matrix spike. So we're getting measures of, on a site basis, we're getting measures of accuracy and precision for the performance of method. It's also, like I had indicated earlier, adapted to extract and analyze soil samples and we've done it in other solid matrices. And I'd like to, before handing over to Daniil, I'd like to acknowledge Meng Yu, who is my principal chemist here at the lab that performs this analysis, and also leave you with some contact information with a couple of my colleagues, Jane Huber and Dave Velasquez. So Daniil, back over to you.
Great, thank you so much, Chuck. So now we've covered the basics of hydrazine, so let's talk about the case study and look at some data. So this project was active from 2012 through 2013. It was a RCRA facility investigation on a 4,000-acre base that supports aerospace development, including the rocket propulsion system testing, which is particularly relevant to hydrazine because, as Chuck mentioned earlier, hydrazine is used as a propellant. This RFI looked at 2 different sites, which are located on a 28-acre complex within the base. That complex was the engine test facility, which was active since 1953. For today's presentation, we're going to focus on Site 1 and specifically on the Site 1 groundwater data. And this is because Site 1 had a hydrazine offloading rack, which was in use since through 1993. Hydrazine was delivered by rail to the offloading rack, and from there it was transferred via underground piping to an above-ground storage tank. Hydrazine is classified as a toxic compound and is unstable in its pure form, so it's typically transported in an aqueous solution of hydrazine and water. So from 2004 through 2008, An RFI at this base was conducted by another firm. Hydrazine was analyzed by ASTM 1385, which is the color metric method that Chuck talked about in the beginning. Hydrazine was detected in six soil borings near Site 1. The highest hit was 21 times over the PRG, which for soil is 0.57 milligrams per kilogram. Hydrazine was also detected in groundwater with concentrations ranging from 5.1 to 6.8 micrograms per liter. And the hydrazine PRG is 0.022 micrograms per liter. So because of the hydrazine detections in groundwater and in the prior RFI, it got incorporated into our data quality objectives for our Site 1. So those data quality objectives were to collect sufficient soil and groundwater data to determine the nature and extent of impacts from the constituents of concern, to close the data gaps from previous investigations, to complete the characterization of the two sites, and to determine if COCs are present at concentrations that present an unacceptable risk to human health and or the environment. This next slide shows our conceptual site model. The COCs were VOCs and SVOCs and hydrazine. According to hydrazine studies, oxidation and biodegradation are the primary removal mechanisms, with degradation in soil being more rapid than in water. So hydrazine really doesn't stick around for very long. So again, the main driver for this was because of the prior detections and the RFI that was conducted from 2004 through 2008. So the main takeaway point from this slide is that the hydrazine rack and the associated piping are the suspected sources of hydrazine in groundwater and the surrounding area. So that was really where we obviously thought that the hydrazine would be coming from. Our first sampling event was in January of 2013, and we sampled from a combination of permanent wells and monitoring wells. We analyzed for VOCs, SVOCs, and of course our favorite, hydrazine. Because the prior work used the ASTM D1385 method, that was the method that we chose to stick with as well to be consistent. And to our surprise, we did have detections of hydrazine in these wells, and they range from, that should actually be 2 to 11 micrograms per liter. These results did not agree with our conceptual site model because the monitoring well locations were upgradient and cross-gradient of the former hydrazine rack. So the results just didn't quite make sense. Our next sampling event was scheduled in April. So because the results were unexpected, we took advantage of that pause between January and April and looked closely at our approach. And we decided that two avenues that bared further investigation were what we were doing in the lab and what our field conditions were. In terms of what we were doing in the lab, we looked at ways that we could improve the method that we were currently using, which again was the ASTM method, and we also researched alternate methods. The first thing that jumped out at us really when we were looking at our data was that our detections were in the lower end or even outside of the usable range of D1385. As Chuck mentioned, this method is color metric and is usable at a range between 5 and 200 micrograms per liter. So with our detections between 2 and 11 micrograms per liter, it really seemed like we were in the very low end. So given that, we suggested a few options that could decrease the measurement uncertainty for D1385. So those options were to require the laboratory to modify the ASTM procedure to use a longer pathway cell to improve agreement with Beer's law at lower concentrations, to require the lab to prepare a calibration curve at lower concentrations and over a smaller range of concentrations, and that would be to verify that the response is truly linear at the lower end of the calibration range, to run a performance check sample on the next round of samples, and finally to do blank corrections or standard additions. So we also, so those were all improvements we felt could be made to the existing ASTM method that we were using at the time if we chose to do that again in April. We also investigated other options for methods and contacted several labs. And after doing our homework, we found that Eurofins Lancaster had the most robust method that included collecting samples with a buffer. So ultimately, we decided that switching to the LC-MS/MS would lower our would lower our detection limits. And again, we're trying to get to that 0.022 micrograms per liter, would increase our sensitivity and provide more. And would also provide more definitive qualitative identification of hydrazine and the presence of interferences. And that kind of flows over to what we were doing in the field as well, because we suspected that the turbidity of the water was causing potential interferences. So we also suggested bringing a ferrous iron kit and using that on the next round. So this next slide is our data. And as you can see, it's pretty clear. Hang on, let me figure out how to move this green arrow. It's pretty clear here. This is our D1385 in January, and these are our detections. And you can see we have a LOQ of 1.5, so well above the 0.022 limit. And then we came back out in April, and this is using the Eurofins Lancaster modified LC-MS/MS method, and all non-detect with a nice low limit of 0.050. And these results were confirmed in October when we sampled again. So in conclusion, the Eurofins Lancaster modified the Eurofins Lancaster modified 8315 method provided data that better achieved our data quality objectives because it reduces interferences. In particular, you got to watch out for turbid groundwater samples, lowered our detection limits. There's field preservation involved, and there's also robust QC. So we did do validation on that, and we're able to look at, you know, LCSs, MSs, those sorts of things. To circle back to the objective of the presentation, we just wanted to take this opportunity to share with you some of the lessons that we learned about hydrazine and what methods are out there. So if you do encounter the need for that on a project, I would encourage you to communicate with your lab and ask questions and really explore methods and definitely consider contacting Chuck so that you make sure you get data that meets your data quality objectives. So that wraps up our presentation. Thank you so much all for your time, and I look forward to your questions.
Very good. Well, Danil and Chuck, appreciate it. I haven't seen any questions pop up just yet specific to your presentation, but if you would, please stick around because they very well may, people you know, in the audience may be submitting questions here shortly. Good scoop, and very much appreciate the presentation. I had a little experience with hydrazine actually in a former life, so I'm a little bit familiar with hydrazine anyway. Again, very much appreciate it. Well, I'll tell you what, in lieu of any questions specific to the hydrazine presentation, I'm going to go ahead and move into some of the questions that we didn't have a chance to get into regarding the other presentations. But again, if you do have a question for Danil or Chuck, by all means, please feel free to submit it. So, the first thing that I wanted to bring up or wanted to ask, and I'm going to throw this over to, yes.
Dwayne, I hate to barge in. This is Roger and Steve in Hawaii. Yes. The fire alarm just went off in our building, and we have to leave. So any questions, just send us an email.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
okay. We got to get out before we get in trouble.
We appreciate it, and please be safe.
Okay, and send us emails if anybody has any questions.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Bye. All right. Well, I was wondering when something like that was going to happen in one of our M2S2 webinars. I'm actually surprised it didn't happen to me, for crying out loud. I didn't want to keep Roger and Steve on the phone too long if they have a have a fire in their building. Wait, Roger, Steve, one more question. But sure enough, we have their bios posted on the webinar page, and if you have questions specifically for Roger or Steve, then by all means get in touch with them, or you can shoot me an email about it. We'll look through the queue of what we have and see if maybe we can answer any questions relative to the presentation with the panel of speakers that we still have on board. So I'm going to throw the first question here to Deb Walker, to my right-hand person for putting this session together, and that's regarding the screening values. Do we have screening values, or are the screening values present in the Corps of Engineers and the MRSPP tool?
Yeah, and I asked Wayne to give me this one because I wanted to make sure everybody understood that the values that are part of the MRSPP are not screening values, as Steve talked about in his presentation. Those are they may be the same numbers, but that's not their purpose. If it's a number that's part of the MRSPP, the Munitions Response Site Prioritization Protocol, that is its purpose in the as being part of the protocol is for prioritization. And that is its only purpose, and so don't get the two confused. And hopefully that kind of answers that question. I didn't want to kind of leave Steve out on the line trying to answer what's really more of a policy question. So.
Yep, absolutely agree. Apples and oranges, two different objectives there. Very good. Well, Deb, while we've got you, I'm gonna throw another one to you here. And, you know, at a lot of the sites, there are actually non-munitions-related chemicals that we're worried about, like solvents, fuel oils, you know, et cetera. So, you know, how do you address that issue on our munitions response sites when you have those sorts of mixed MC and other non-munitions-related chemicals?
And this one is also really more of a policy thing, and I would refer people to read the relevant piece of the what is called the DERP manual, the Defense Environmental Restoration Program Manual. It talks about the different program elements, and it all comes down to money at some point in many ways. But there's different program elements, and there's the Installation Restoration Program, which covers more the traditional environmental cleanup things, and then there's the Military Munitions Response Program, which covers more things that blow up. And the two, there is allowance for incidental IRP work within the MMRP, and there's not really a firm definition of incidental within the DERP manual, but I think the intent there is that it's to allow you to address the small things that come up when you're on a project. It's not for you to do a whole other project within a project. So I hope that answers the question. And you know, it's one of those things where I encourage you to read the information in the manual yourself, because usually it's always good to get it straight from, I want to say, the horse's mouth. I don't know if you can say that about a DOD guidance, but they're not a horse, are they, Dwayne?
Yeah, we probably shouldn't classify them as any animal there. Not a horse. Yep. All right, good, Dev. Steve Ramish, are you still with us?
I'm here.
Excellent. Okay, got a question for you that I believe, you know, relates directly to your presentation here. And it was, shouldn't that be a chemical potential concern at burn pits that use diesel?
If that's what comes up during your TPP planning process, then yeah, it could be. But again, that's part of the conceptual understanding the conceptual site model and potential release mechanisms, and then that's also something that should be discussed and agreed upon and get concurrence on at the start of the project.
Okay, very good. I believe this next question also came in during your presentation. I believe that you'd be a good person to handle it anyway. And, you know, several of the indicator metals that you mentioned, you know, the copper, lead, zinc, you know, those are very common inorganic compounds that are contributed from a variety of different ambient sources. So, you know, you could have concentrations that are quite above, you know, considerably above, you know, the background levels. And so, you know, it seems like distinguishing between background and the small arms contributions, that's a very simplistic approach, or maybe it's a too complex approach now to think about it. Anyway, have you had to work with issues like that at some of the sites?
To try to distinguish between background munitions-related and non-munitions-related contributions? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, for those very common constituents, the copper, lead, zinc, where you may have a lot of contributing sources.
For the scope of the projects that we've worked on, no. We've kind of, and usually it just ends up being that if you find them at a known munitions site, essentially it just gets attributed to the munitions activities. I have not really come across a site where we've where we really had a reason to try to distinguish between munitions related and non-munitions related. You do have to, again, understand the site and try to collect. If there are the best approach would be is if there are non-munitions related sources. For example, the thing that's popping in my mind is you may have lead that's present from old gasoline emissions, you know, from along roads or something historically, and you want to try to distinguish that from lead that may be present. Some of it can be handled through being smart about your collection of background samples, you know, and being able to identify areas that may have been affected by non-munitions activities but not by munitions activities, although that's easier said than done in reality.
Right. Yeah, I agree. To me, it seems that it does tie back into having the best possible, most robust conceptual site model that you could have, and if there are clearly potential contributors, then you know there's even possibly could be, you know, PRP projects, and not gonna talk a whole lot about that there, but those are the things that teams have to wrestle with when you have those multiple contributors there. Let's see, Jay, are you still on the line? Do we still have you?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. Is there a published reference paper that talks about the distribution of potential contaminants across the range? And I believe the question refers to, like, the spatial distribution of contaminants across ranges.
If you just Google Krell and explosives, there are dozens and dozens of reports. Now, again, these are mostly focused on active ranges. So these wouldn't be the older ranges like the ones that the MMRP program deals with.
Okay. But there are sources then that can be gone to try to help find that sort of information.
And they can contact me if they're interested too. I just had a chapter in a book published that broke out MC by different types of range activities.
Okay, very good. This one, and I'm not sure whether you'll know the answer to this one or not, but I'll put it out there anyway. And do you have an idea of kind of what are the time periods, excuse me, that that propellants and explosives, pyrotechnics, that those could exist in an arid environment? And then kind of a follow-on, do you have any sort of information on regarding CWM for the same sort of question?
Well, I know there was, and I can't remember who did it. It's been a long time since I looked at it, but there was a study done in an arid environment, and basically what the individual did is they had some chunks of explosives that were sitting out there in the environment, and they monitored them over a period of 20 years or something like that. And, you know, basically it just broke up into smaller and smaller pieces, but it was still there. So, boy, I don't remember who did that. It's been too long, but there is a report out there on that, a paper.
Okay. Okay. So, again, you may be able to find a little bit of information that could help with that.
Okay. Yeah, in terms of the chemical weapons, well, I'm not really familiar with that literature. I'm not sure what's out there on that.
Right. Yeah, I would suggest people consult with our CWM Design Center on anything like that. Deb, I've got another question. Since this one is kind of broader, I wanted to get your thoughts on it, your insight into it. And the question is, it concerns perchlorate, and, you know, what munitions other than rockets are perchlorates associated with? And then got kind of a follow-up question about RDX that I'll get to in a second, but I'll let you talk about perchlorate and the sources and origins of perchlorate.
Well, we talked a lot about ITRC teams on this call when Roger and Steve were on there, and I was part of the ITRC perchlorate team. I can't remember if that's one of the ones Jay was part of too or not, but as part of that and as part of working with the DOD working group on perchlorate, which was what preceded our current merit team with OSD, we actually put out a DOD perchlorate handbook that is published on DENIX. And that actually includes a pretty good workup of where all it came, what all kind of munitions that it's been documented in. But the kind of short list is flares, rockets, smoke, incendiaries, jet assisted takeoff, motors, simulators, tracers, and there's a couple of mines. So that's kind of the short list. For those of you who couldn't take down the notes on something that was that fast, you can pretty much, I think you can find the perchlorate handbook if you just Google DOD perchlorate handbook. Also, we neglected to think about this ahead of time, but we are going to give Gene a copy of our interim guidance document 1401, which is the draft version of our EM 200-1-15. And if you're not familiar with it, it is pretty much everything the Corps thinks about as far as technical resources for military munition response. And it's got two chapters that have a whole lot about munitions constituent sampling. That's not all that's in there, but there's a lot of things in there about munitions constituents. And conveniently enough, in 7.6.7, the information that I just quoted you about perchlorate is referenced. So we will get that posted under seminar resources. So when you come back to this for reference or, you know, whatever you might want to do with it, you'll have the link, and we'll get that and Gene can have it posted.
Yep, that's a very good idea, Deb. I wish that I'd thought of that. But, yeah, to get the 1401 posted under the resources, yeah, we'll get that put up so that everybody can access that. Very good. Very good. Okay.
And Jean just posted the link to the perchlorate handbook because she's very effective.
I saw it. Yeah, Gene's already posted the link to the perchlorate handbook on the Denix website, so that has already popped up if anybody is interested in getting that resource.
And as long as I have the volume, Duane, I wanted to point out that there was a couple of questions that came in. I wasn't sure if we'd have time to answer them, and they may have more interest than just the questioner. And so I answered those to all instead of just privately. So if you look in the little question box, there's a couple of things about the underwater munition study that the Hawaii guys were talking about, and also about some of the acronyms people might be unfamiliar with as far as the EHE and HHE. So I just wanted to point out to those in case anybody else had interest in them.
Okay, very good. Hey, Deb, we had a follow-up question also. And it's not really to do with perchlorate, but it came in as an addendum, if you will, to the perchlorate question. And you may not know the answer to it off the top of your head. I know that I've seen this information, but I can't recall it off the top of my head either. And do you recall, what year did DOD start using RDX?
The best information I have is that as far as fielding it, it was after World War II. There was some limited training in the latter part of World War II, but as far as actual fielding to the troops, it was after World War II, so late 40s. And I know that's not an exact date, and everybody wants to get a date that they can say, okay, on November 1st, 1945, well, we don't have a date like that, because that's not really the way the military works. They kind of gradually feel things, and so there'll be things that, you know, they're moving into, and there'll be things that they're testing, and so probably they were testing it some before that, and so if you're looking at a test site, you might be seeing something a little bit different than that, but if you're looking at just general use, that's a pretty good estimate.
Yeah, it could have been later than that, too, because they had TNT-filled rounds in the inventory back in the States, and so when they brought the munitions back from Europe in World War II, they tend to use up the older munitions first, and so the RDX-filled munitions could sit in the inventory for a number of years before they're actually used.
Good. Good. Good info. Jay, I'm gonna go back to you again for another question here, and that was, how do the sorption and transport properties, how do those change if you have organic solvents or oils present?
That's a good question. I have not seen any studies looking at the interaction of explosive constituents with chlorinated solvents. I would suspect that. You know, if the explosives were there first on the soil or whatever and the spill occurred later, that the explosives would dissolve into the solvent. But I have not seen any studies on that.
Okay. All right, very good. Oh, and hey, Deb, just to go back real quick on the RDX question, do you recall some similar information about HMX, about when, you know, what general time frame that it would have been fielded?
You know, I have not actually looked into that with the same degree of depth that I've looked at RDX, but I would kind of assume that it's probably something pretty similar, just because it is something that is it's made through pretty much the same processes. So. Right. You know, but I have not actually investigated that to any extent.
Yep. Yeah, I'm right there with you. I think, you know, my understanding was that they were fielded at about the same time or the same era, if you will. But again, that's just purely anecdotal from Duane. So don't.
And the top data print is so much higher that, you know, compared to RDX, that I've just never paid it that much attention, to be honest.
Right. Jay, another question for you is, what does nitroglycerin, what does that biotransform into?
I don't remember off the top of my head. but there are a variety of long organic molecules, and eventually we'll break down all the way down to carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. But there, okay, there are a number of intermediate products, and they have very long names, and I don't remember what they are.
Okay, very good. And do you, what kind of munitions is tungsten? What kind of munitions is tungsten prevalent in?
So the Army, I think it was 2005 or so, they had a replacement program for lead in small arms ammunition, and they were using tungsten cores. So that would be the 5.56 round, the 7.62. I think there was one other round. I can't remember what it was. So that was the okay. most recent. But there are older rounds. Like I found some evidence that the 50 cal round used back in the 50s. Some specific lots had tungsten in them. And then there are a variety of other munitions that have tungsten in them. Actually, there are quite a few.
Okay. But correct me if I'm interpreting what you just said incorrectly, but so it sounds like more contemporary munitions, the tungsten's going to be more prevalent in. Is that correct?
Yeah, but there are some older rounds that had tungsten in them.
Okay.
So you just need to go, I can't remember where that information is anymore. There's a site out there that the Army has where you can look up the Denex. Maybe Deborah
remembers. It's Midas. We also have included that in the there's a section on tungsten in that document that we're going to get Gene to post, and that does include some information on what rounds it's in, because it is in things like penetrators, for example, armor piercing, that sort of thing.
Right. Okay. Very good. Now, also regarding tungsten, do you know, are there any analytical issues associated with analyzing for tungsten in soil?
There are, and I have a paper out that discusses that. Tony Bednar has a paper out discussing that as well. Basically, you need to get the tungsten in solution, and you need to keep it in solution, and so the way that you do that is usually you add phosphoric acid to the digestion reagent. And in the new method for 3050B for metals, which will be 3050C, there will be an appendix or a section discussing those digestion modifications.
Okay. Very good. Let's see here. We have several questions that it looks like were very very specific to Steve and Roger's presentation. I'll check just in case it was they let him back in the building. It was a fire drill, a test, or a false alarm. Stephen Roger, have you possibly been able to rejoin us? Okay. Well, I will again just defer any questions if you have specific questions relative to incremental sampling. And even more specifically to their experience with using it and why, then I would just recommend you get directly in touch with them. Let's see. Deb, here's one that's a little more general regarding MIS sampling. And so I'm going to see if you we've already talked about that one. Let's see here. I'm skipping around here and trying to find the questions that weren't. Let's see here. Okay, we did have a few questions that came in that were concerning the hydrazine presentation. And so, Danelle and Chuck, are you? You still here? You with us? Can we throw a couple of questions to you?
I'm still
sure,
on.
I'm still here.
Yeah.
Perfect. All right. Excellent. Appreciate it. And the first one was, did you provide a blind PE sample for hydrazine?
We did not, and that was one of our recommendations for if we continue to use the ASTM method would be to do a blind check sample.
Okay. Good. And here, would you could you comment on the results of the iron field test method?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. I'm going to have to, I remember them coming back as being turbid, but I do not remember what the results were. I'd be happy to look that up and get back to that person later. I'm sorry about that. I should have been ready for that one.
Okay. Nope. Very good. Very good. Like I said, we appreciate you the presentation and answering the questions you can. It's hard. You can't fill them all. And here's another one that came in, and it was for the LC-MS-MS. Was that also derivatized?
The LC-MS-MS analysis?
Correct.
Wayne, is that what you're asking, if it was derivatized to perform the analysis?
Well, I'm assuming that's what the question
asked. Yes, and the answer is, just want to make sure I answer it correctly, yes, in that analytical method, we had to do the derivatization, but in this case, the derivatization was not to create a color, like for the colorimetric, but the derivatization was to essentially add more molecular mass, more molecular weight to the hydrazine compounds so that the LC-MS-MS analytical instrumentation could do a better job of detecting and quantifying the compounds.
Okay. Good. I have a question here, and I'm not sure. I think there's several people who could address this. And Deb, I'm first gonna draw upon you since you're kind of my go-to person for, again, all things MC. But if we need to redirect it or somebody has some insight, then please pipe up, because I'm not sure where this came in or exactly which presentation it was referring to. But do we have any information on aluminum and iron in the surface soil migrating to groundwater? And is there any evidence of that happening at munition sites?
And right off the top of my head, I'm unaware of any information one way or the other. I'll defer to Jay if he knows of any.
No, I don't. You know, we looked at that a little bit when I worked on the Mass Military Reservation, because I couldn't really differentiate any anthropological background. I mean, there were hot spots, if you will, scattered here and there, but I wasn't convinced that really there was an impact from training activities. And then in terms of groundwater, we saw, you know, aluminum, iron, and manganese in the water, but we determined most of that was associated with particulates in the sample. And the way we figured that out was we did both dissolved and total samples, and so we could differentiate the fact that the high metals concentration with the totals analysis was primarily due to particulates in the sample, and that was confirmed with turbidity analysis as well.
Okay, very good. Appreciate it. And it looks to me like, from what I'm seeing on our question queue, I believe that we've run through all of the questions except the ones that were, again, specific to Roger and Steve's presentation. If I've overlooked anything, please don't hesitate to get in touch with either me or Deb or one of the speakers for further clarification. And I think we're about ready to wrap things up. I see that, Gene, you read my mind, because I asked you to bring up our poll questions. And the Jay, since we have you, I know that a couple of these questions that were relative to your material, and so regardless of the voting results, the crowdsourcing, I'm going to ask you to confirm the correct answer for your two questions, which
All
are
right,
questions
perfect.
Number 3 and 4, just to clarify.
Correct. So most people got number 3 wrong. 2,4-DNT is not a transformation product of TNT. It's the 2-amino dinitrotoluene, so sometimes referred to as 2A 4-6 amino or 2A amino dash 4-6 dinitrotoluene, or there's another intermediary product referred to as DANT, diamino nitrotoluene. So those are the transformation products. And as Ed had mentioned, and I checked this real quick, TNB is an impurity in TNT, and it also can be photoproduced through the transformation of TNT, although that's not a common pathway. And then the other question, nitroglycerin and DNTs are susceptible to transformation processes. Everybody got that right.
Very good. Well, that was good. Well, I was very curious to see if on question three, suddenly we started seeing everybody changing their votes. But it looks like everybody stuck by their guns on that. But I appreciate you clarifying it and providing the correct answer to everyone. The other two questions, question one and two, those really came from our incremental sampling material for those presentations. And the answer, the correct answer for both of those questions, they are both true, in case anybody was wondering. And then I also see that it appears that we can go ahead and decree the Oregon Ducks as the national champion for the 2014 college football season. So congratulations there to the Oregon Ducks. You know, I'm not sure why we even need a playoff series now. But I'm still going to watch. Looks like it'll be fun. Appreciate everybody voting on that. And with that, the last things that I want to mention is, again, please register for any future webinars, M2SU webinars that we have scheduled. We have three more for FY15. I want to throw out a big shout of thanks to our speakers for taking the time to put together the presentation and sharing their thoughts with us. A lot of work goes into that. It's not an easy thing to do. It takes time away from their day, from their other tasks. And so I want to issue a collective thank you to our speakers. I also very much want to thank Deb Walker for helping pull together the material and working with our subject matter experts, our speakers, to put the session together. And so with that, I can't believe that I have anything else except to throw it to Gene. And Gene, let me ask, what were our Nielsen ratings today? How did we do on attendance? And wrap it up for us.
All right. Thanks so much, Dwayne. You had about 270 people who were able from all over the world for today's live broadcast. So we did have some great numbers for today's session. I'm going to echo the thanks to the speakers again who came from as far away as Hawaii to get up very early and offer one of their talks. So we really do appreciate everybody taking time to join us both as a presenter and a participant. Just a few final closing reminders for those of you who are still with us on the line. We do get a number of requests for training records for those of you that use participation in these webinars to keep up with mandatory technical training for your jobs. And you can go to the following website on the CLUIN site and actually enter in your email address. We will send you an automated table via email, which will list all of the CLUIN webinars that you have participated and checked in live for. We're working on updating that list to also include things that may have been archived that you replayed, but that part isn't quite ready yet for prime time. So at a very minimum, we can at least give you an automated email list of those that you attended live. If you need additional help documenting or verifying webinars you've attended, feel free to reach out to me directly by email. As we noted earlier today, copies of the presentation materials that were made available for today's session are currently posted on the seminar resources or links page. If you're replaying the archived version of today's session, you'll find a direct link to that right under the middle box that says related URLs. There should be a hyperlink to seminar resources. If you click that and press the Browse To button, that'll open up a site where you can download PDF copies of these materials. And the additional documents that were brought up during the Q&A session will be posted there as well. So we'll update that so we'll have a complete listing of all of the related information resources talked about today. And those links will remain active from this point forward. We will also ask if you can just take a brief moment and fill out our short online feedback form. I know our organizers, as well as myself, really do depend upon your feedback to help us to continue to deliver sessions like this online. If you shared the line with multiple people, each person can actually fill out their own feedback form. And this can be particularly helpful, again, for those of you looking to use this webinar as a training requirement. We don't issue training certificates for our webinars. However, if you fill out the feedback form, there is a box you can check which is circled in red on this sample form. And if you have your email address correctly and you check that box when submitting your form, we will send you a confirmation email that at least verifies you submitted feedback after the live delivery. If you're, again, watching the recorded version, you too can follow those links to the seminar feedback form and fill out a copy of that feedback form and get one of these confirmation emails. Many participants are able to document and earn credit for attending the webinars with those confirmation emails and either printouts of the homepage or copies of the presentation materials. As I mentioned, today's session was recorded, and we will automatically share an email link to replay that recording with all registered participants. Once you receive that email, you'll certainly be welcome to forward that on to anybody else that you think will find it a valuable expenditure of their time. So I think that's the end of the reminders that I have today. So Dwayne, if there's nothing else from your end, I just want to thank everybody for joining us today, and hopefully you'll join us when we carry on with the M2S2 webinar series next calendar year in February when we carry on with the next session. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.